Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Action Radio. This is Greg Penglis coming to you from the historic district of downtown Milton on the banks of the beautiful Blackwater River. And now let's get into Action Radio. Here we go again. It's another exciting week here on Action Radio. Well, maybe not. I don't know. I don't have a lot of guests planned. I don't think I have any guests planned this week. Last week, we had a couple of cool folks. We had Lawyer Lisa and maybe that was it. But it's the summertime. You know, I'm having trouble getting guests. They're doing stuff. They're all hanging out at the beach. You know, they're just kind of cruising, taking it easy. This is a pretty lazy time of year. Besides that, it's hot out. I feel like, oh, no, global warming. Well, it's called summertime. Of course it's global warming. It's always warming in the summertime. But it's also global cooling at the other side of the earth, you know, below the equator, down there in the southern hemisphere. So that's what's happening. I think this is going to be a very interesting day. I've been sort of gathering stuff from Ukraine. And I was talking to somebody about investigating and how you investigate and where I find the articles I find. And the reason I find the articles that I find is because I look for them. I look for specific titles. You know, I had an idea last night, and I said, well, what can I find in the Ukraine war? Well, let's put into the search engine, the Ukraine war cannot be won. And, of course, you get 30 articles why it can be won, which is all leftist propaganda. And once you get past them and see the article, then you get to, like, the good one. Well, and I found that one. So usually one out of between 30 and 50 articles that I look at is actually useful for the show. And so it just depends. But you got to put the right question in. It's like way back when we started doing things with COVID. And this is back in February of 2020. And I asked three words, what kills viruses? Because I knew that the vaccine was a crock. You don't try and make something that takes 15 years and build up immunity, you know, for something for a virus that's already here. You treat it and you kill it. That's how you treat, that's what you do with a disease that's already here. You know, and so I knew this was a bunch of BS because it was already too late. And it was illogical to think that you should, you know, totally skip treatments for something that's already here. That's how New Fauci was a liar and a fraud, because all they talked about was vaccines. Well, that's crazy. That makes no sense. And so you use a little bit of simple logic and away you go. And then, of course, you get into this cult of the expert. And the cult of the expert, I was thinking about this, Pianki and I were talking about this. We used to have this leftist caller that would say, well, you're not an expert. You're not a doctor. You know, or she asked me once, do you know as much as a Supreme Court judge? And I'm thinking to myself, about what? You know, I mean, some things, yeah, some things, no, but that's not the point. That what she was really saying is you don't have the right to question unless you have the same degree they do. And of course, my answer is, well, that would take all reporters out of questioning anybody for something they don't have a degree in. So if a reporter is not a lawyer, I guess they can't ask a politician who is a lawyer a question because they're not an expert. They wouldn't understand. You know, and this could go anywhere. I mean, how do people vote unless they have a degree in whatever the person they're voting for also has? Because so they can determine whether they're an expert or not and be able to ask a question. So it gets really stupid and silly. But a lot of times the question asked is not actually the question that's being asked. So the title of the show today, and I got Josh on the line. I'll get to him in just a little bit here. So, America, how does it feel to be a colony of the Ukraine? And we'll talk more and more about this as the hour goes on. But it seems to me that whenever the deep state, the military-industrial complex gets – yeah, Marco's there. Yeah, hey, Marco. Marco's in the Netherlands. So I got Josh in Illinois. I got Marco in the Netherlands. And I've got whoever else is listening now or will be listening, you know, during one of the podcasts. Still, most people are listening by podcast. I really like to get you live if possible when you can, simply because the live chat is available when we're live. And you can call in. We've got a Skype line. You know, well, I'll give the information in just a minute. I got a new promo on that. But it seems to me that when we get one of these undeclared, illegal, unconstitutional, you know, multi-trillion-dollar wasteful nation-building things that really aren't wars, it's like a state of war, but it's not really a war. A real war, you go in, you kill the enemy, and you go home. You know, but our wars, we don't do that anymore. Now we just kind of go in and spend money. It's like we don't use bullets, we use money. Well, yeah, there's bullets involved, but for the most part, we're spending money, and we're spending lots of money. You know, we're spending money that we could spend here, you know, and these countries become like colonial masters. I mean, Afghanistan was our colonial master because it took so much money and so many people and took our arms and then they kept them. Well, that's what a colonist would do. That's what the British did when they went around to different countries. You know, they took all the resources, they took all the people who worked for them, they paid taxes and it all went to the colonial masters. Well, it's like we turn these countries into masters, colonial masters. So Ukraine is now master of the U.S. because you've got the stand-up comedian who faked playing a piano with his man part on a video, which is actually rather funny, by the way, but that's not doesn't make you a presidential leader or a prime minister who wears his green fatigues, much like Fidel Castro whenever he went to the U.N., to look very military, gets up there and says, well, America's sons and daughters have to come fight alongside with us. No, we don't. This is your problem. This is your country. This is an Eastern European problem. This is a European problem. But the one problem it's not is an American problem because the Soviet Union, because Russia is not going to attack the United States from the Ukraine. Ain't going to happen. So when you look at all this, how all this goes, in fact, I got a fascinating article on how it's very much like the reason that the Ukraine can't beat the Soviet Union is the same reason that the South could not beat the Union in the Civil War here. It's fascinating. Anyway, so that's the kind of stuff that's going on. So as you look at what's happening with Ukraine, they are acting, or we are, in fact, it's kind of like the reverse. They're not acting as a colonial power. We are making them a colonial power. And a corrupt one at that, because they've got money laundering. You got the Clinton Foundation and and all the Democrats, probably Republicans too. It's a money laundering operation. It's definitely a drug operation. I'm sure it's a child trafficking operation. They've got biolabs, so they got the bio warfare operation. They're a money pit, which will take endless amount of money. They're out of ammo. They really can't wage war anymore. The only ability they have to wage war is from stuff that we're giving them. So if we didn't give them anything, then the war would be over. Because, if one side can't fight, the war ends. That's how it works, right? So they'd actually have to do what we've wanted all along, which is a negotiated peace. And so that was always the result. Ukraine was never going to win the war. It's only a question of how badly they're going to lose the war and how much we're going to spend having them lose the war and go to what we're going to go to anyway without the war, which is a negotiated peace. That's where we stand. So we're the colony. We're the colony that supplies the tax dollars, the arms, the people. We got F-16s, cluster bombs, all kinds of other, war crimes materials that are going over there. And we're doing everything possible to reduce ourselves to a colony of Ukraine. And quite frankly, I'm sick of it. I didn't want to be a colony of Iraq. I didn't want to be a colony of Afghanistan. I certainly didn't want to be a colony of Vietnam back then. That we become colonies of these countries, in effect, because they control us. They control our agenda. Everything that happens in Washington is now based on what happens in Ukraine. Including climate change, according to John Kerry. So it's a really quite a fascinating thing. All right, let me play a promo, my new promo here with our information, then I'll get to Josh and see what's on his mind. Here is your Action Radio contact and website information. The call-in line is 215-383-3832. Our show site is blogtalkradio.com/citizenaction. Same link, live and a podcast. Please share all our shows. We have live chat at the bottom of the broadcast page available worldwide. Sign in to your free account and type away. We have an internet Skype line where you can call the show worldwide also. Please see the broadcast page for our Skype name. Call in during the show to get approved. Our bill writing site is writeyourlaws.com. WriteYourLaws, writeyourlaws.com. This is where anyone can write a bill and start the process of it becoming law. My paid and free subscription column is at gregpenglis.substack.com. Please consider a paid subscription of $5 per month or greater. For contributions to Action Radio, please go to givesendgo.com/actionradio. We have over 20 Action Radio Facebook groups. Use the Facebook search window by putting in Action Radio to find our groups. My public email is greg@writeyourlaws.com. Please contact me about advertising on Action Radio and helping our mission of freedom. Thank you for listening. All right, let's bring on Josh and see what's on his mind. Good morning, sir. What's going on?
I just wanted to point out that you brought up the Vietnam War, and that really showed your age there, bud.
That really showed what now? I missed what you said.
I'm sorry. That showed your age there, bud.
I'm 63. I show my age all the time.
The old guard on the network. No, I think that's obviously ridiculous because what they're actually asking for is not only our resources, but they're actually Zelensky coming out and saying, your kids might have to come over here and fight alongside us.
I said they would. Not might, would. We do have to fight alongside them.
That's so not going to happen.
Well, yeah, well, wait a minute. We got 3,000 reservists that just went over.
Did you see Vivek Ramaswamy? He was like, yeah, we can give them the Donbass, and they already have Crimea. We could probably just not
be
involved in
that. What do you mean we can give
them?
They've already taken it. It's not a question of we can give them. We're not going to, you know, it's not ours to give or ours to take back. It's got nothing to do with us.
Yes, sir. That's what I'm saying. It has mm-hmm. nothing to do with us at all.
Mm-hmm.
We can only be mediators with mm-hmm. the biggest arsenal to respond. Yeah. Tucker Carlson did that thing over there at TPUSA's event like 2 days ago. He was mm-hmm. like, when I see two of my kids fighting, you know, I can compare this to global politics in the same way that I can have it in my household. When I come home... And two of my kids, I don't care who's right or wrong. When I walk in, daddy's home. You better stop fighting.
Yeah.
And that's what America
there is no
is supposed
daddy.
To be.
There is no daddy.
That's
in,
what America's
in...
supposed to be. That's
well,
what
yeah,
we're supposed
but...
to be on the world stage.
That's good. That's an interesting point. I haven't thought about it. I'm going to have to think about how that works. I don't want to be the daddy because the daddy is responsible. An authority figure, I think what we should be, is kind of like the, what would be a good place for us to be? So like the guiding principle. It's like we lead by example, but we don't enforce. And I don't know how you'd put that. I mean, our job is not to be the police officer. Our job is to be like the inspiration.
What was that? The home improvement, the neighbor that had his eyes over the fence. That's what we should be.
No, I don't think so either. I think we can definitely have leadership positions, but we're not like Michael Rennie's robot, you know, the day the earth stood still. We're not Klaatu, you know, so it's kind of interesting. I love movie metaphors, especially before my time, which is kind of funny. But yeah, you know, it's like people, oh, I love when you joke about that. Well, you're showing your age, dude. Well, hell, I listened to Beethoven and, you know, but I wasn't born then, like 1850. Doesn't mean it's not good. All right, so what do you think of Vivek? I'd be really curious what your take on Vivek Swami is.
Vivek Ramaswamy, I think that he would be an awesome vice president either way.
Why?
Because no matter – why do I think that? Because I think he's mm-hmm. very annoying in the national conversation.
That's a great analogy. He's annoying. That's a great vice president. But see, vice presidents, you pick a vice president because they could be president. That's the number one duty of the vice president is to be able to be president,
buddy,
which is why Kamala Harris isn't qualified to be dog catcher.
She was qualified to wash the toilets maybe.
But she's part of the idiocracy. I mean, you look at the entire government that was stolen.
You said the word idiocracy out loud.
I said idiocracy out loud, yeah. No, you've got a government that was stolen and staffed by morons, complete idiots. You know, you look at any of the cabinet officials. In fact, I got a column coming out. You know, government is never wrong. You know, which is, I mean, you want to talk about irony and satire. I mean, the whole piece is like contradiction. But I was working out this morning. I was working out last night. I was hoping to get it done before the show, but not quite yet. it's not. You know, it's like sculpture. When it's done, it's done, and until then, it's not done. So I don't release it until it's done. So I'll get there on that. Talking about, I forgot how I got into this tack, but yeah, Swami, I was looking at the internet last night. I said, you know, who is this guy? What, and there's a column by J.D. Rucker a while back, a couple of weeks ago, talking about how he reminds him of Obama. And it got me thinking. I didn't trust him in the beginning because he's too slick. I never trust anybody that's too slick. And so I'm looking at Swami and I go, there's something wrong with this guy. I don't know what it is. Then I read the J.D. Rucker piece saying he's like Obama. He's young. He's, you know, he's like hope and change and all this other kind of stuff. He's a minority. He's a person of color. You know, he's a young, successful businessman. So that'll appeal to the conservatives as opposed to a young community organizer, which would appeal to the Democrats in the case of Obama. But he's like Obama, too. I don't trust this guy one bit. I think there's something really wrong with him, really dangerous about him. It's just, I mean, how do you make a, you know, multi-billion dollars at 37 years old with no obvious product that he's invented? What has he invented? What did he create to give him $37 billion?
Can I toss an alternative?
Sure.
Make him the Secretary of Transportation. Apparently anybody can do that.
Hmm. Apparently anybody can sit on the Supreme Court. Anybody can be Secretary of Energy. Anybody can be Secretary of State. Anybody can be Secretary of Defense.
I can pick any office, you stupid moron. You're missing the forest for the trees.
You could take five homeless people and they probably do a better job than the current cabinet because they're all idiots.
Okay. You know what, Greg? I actually agree with you. Yes.
Oh, thank you.
No, I agree with you.
What do you mean actually agree with me? Like it never happens? We can agree. We agree on a bunch of stuff. But something wrong with Swami. I'm calling him Swami just because I think it's funny. But what is it about him that he's too perfect? You know, there's something.
And I know that. No, but that's why he can never win. He can never win like right now. There's no way in heck. He might be like third or fourth. Like he would make like a really awesome. Well, no, I already told you. He would be
what's his track
Secretary
record?
Of Transportation.
What's his track record?
His track record is being a brown guy and being worth millions of dollars.
Mm-hmm. Well, billions of dollars. And how do you make his money?
No. His business that he created, the biotech industry business he created, is worth billions. Mm-hmm. He's only worth hundreds of millions.
Okay. Yeah. And what products have they brought to the market?
You and me are in the same boat not knowing that. Yeah, I have no idea.
What products did he bring to market? Okay. It's like Moderna. Moderna was created to create messenger RNA vaccines, you know, as part of the pandemic. We know why they were created. You know, they hack the software of life. They take computer programs, binary codes, and combine that with messenger RNA, with amino acids, and that's how they create their own stuff. Fascinating technology, but Moderna doesn't actually own anything. They don't actually own vaccines. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sorry. No, I wasn't trying to interrupt you. His whole claim to fame was that he was the CEO of a biotech company, and after everybody was trying to push him onto the BLM stuff, and he was like, no, I'm not going to do that. And then he was pushed out of his own company, and he sold all of his shares. And
what's his background?
So that
he doesn't look like Wesley Snipes or Martin Luther King. Who is he? He looks more like Dinesh D'Souza. So I'm just curious if I can jump.
Oh my God! You really okay? Nope. We went there.
What do you mean? We always go there.
this is my whole thing about Vivek Ramaswamy. He is the most intelligent person on the stage in like 40% of the topics that they're talking about, but he even has the personality, the upward mobility, the way that you want to energize people. He doesn't have the track record at all, and you
he's
know
Obama.
Neither did Trump. But Trump,
he's Obama.
Trump
had
80%.
Trump
come
had,
on,
had
don't you call him Obama? Don't do that to him.
Obama
was a senator. No, no.
Hope and change.
Obama.
Hope and change,
okay,
baby.
Okay, time out.
Swami.
Nope.
Hope and change.
Time
it's coming.
Out, time
Watch.
Out. Time out.
Watch.
You know why you're wrong?
Three-panel picture.
Do you know why you're wrong?
Why?
Okay. Obama was he wrote his dissertation to, like, be the big dog off of Saul Alinsky.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing that Hillary Clinton did.
Mm-hmm.
He was a community manager,
organizer
in Chicago.
Yeah,
I'm sorry,
Acorn.
Okay, yeah, but this guy's from Ohio. You know how many things are pretty sweet in Ohio these days?
Mm. Like a train's derailing, I know that.
Okay, that was a low blow.
All right, hold on.
That was
hold
a low
on.
Blow.
Let me. No, it wasn't. Let me read you a headline here. Now Pianki's on the line too, so let me read you a headline. Vivek Ramaswamy paid to get Soros connection erased from Wikipedia page. Oops, told you he was a plant.
Is that real?
Yeah, it's the Huffington Post. It's by David Moy, M-O-Y-E, May 3rd, 2023, 3:50 p.m. Eastern Daylight Savings Time. A Wikipedia editor's page notes they apparently accepted money to edit the GOP presidential candidate's article. I told you it was a Soros plan. You didn't believe me. I'm just getting your view before I sprung this on you. The article says, Republican I'm so bad. We went there, yeah, like you said. Republican presidential candidate Vivek Ramaswamy, affectionately known here as Swamy, reportedly paid to have his Wikipedia page scrubbed of potentially politically damaging details about his past. Mediaite is reporting that the page now includes a warning that this article has, quote, multiple issues, quote, contains paid contributions, and may require cleanup to comply with Wikipedia's content policies, particularly neutral point of view. The Wikipedia's article version history shows that in February, an editor identified by Mediaite as Jay Offerman, I'll find out who that is in a bit, removed lines about Ramaswamy receiving a Paul and Daisy Soros Fellowship for New Americans in 2011. Since Paul Soros is the older brother of billionaire George Soros, who funds many progressive causes, it's understandable Ramaswamy wouldn't want potential voters to be aware of that connection. Notice he doesn't brag about it. He didn't say about it in the Turning Point speech. It says Ramaswamy's speech was also edited to remove his role on the state of Ohio's COVID-19 response team. He's a COVID vaxxer. He's biotech, right? So he's probably in on the Pfizer stuff, too. We just haven't made the connection yet. Anyway, it says, which an editor noted. I'm not done. Hold on. I'll give you a chance.
I just wanted to clarify Trump 2024.
Okay, fine. Ramaswamy's page was also edited to remove his role on the state of Ohio's COVID-19 response team, which an editor noted came on Ramaswamy's request to have his COVID-era work removed. Meanwhile, the editor deemed Ramaswamy's Soros Fellowship, quote, extraneous material. In other words, really valuable stuff. Ramaswamy announced his presidential run, here we go, just 2 weeks after the changes to the Wikipedia page. How effing convenient is that? That's not in the article, that's me. Jay Hockerman's user page on the website notes that Ramaswamy paid him for his work on the page. Wikipedia editors debated the conflict of interest after the alterations were made. Mediaite notes that the reference to Ramaswamy's fellowship was later added to the page, but his work on Ohio's COVID team is still absent. Now, what do you think?
He had a bunch of money. And he seemed pretty suave, and Trump had a bunch of money, but he pissed everybody off.
But Trump didn't take a Soros, award. A little bit different.
They keep putting American politicians on the WEF like platform, and I think like 8 politicians in America are suing them for like, we're not involved with you at all.
Yeah, I'm not going to worry about that. Yeah, that's that deserves further investigation, but not today. Pianki, what do you think of George Soros or Soros awarded Vivek Ramaswamy? Pianki.
Well, good morning to
morning.
You and your guest, Alan.
No, it's Josh. Josh,
no,
Alan,
no,
he's
how are you
before.
Doing? Josh, I'm sorry. You know, I run through so many names. No,
I know,
he's
it's so confusing here.
he outwardly supports Article 5, Convention of States, along with Ben Shapiro, Colonel Alan West, and Ben Carson. So
isn't that special?
That there gets a plus with me.
Yeah, I know, but that's not going to get anywhere with me. But what do you think about the thing that I think he's hiding from? I don't trust
with
him.
You just one person. It may not get in place with you, but a lot of other things don't get in place with you. So people have a right.
Pianki, everybody's just one person.
Right.
What? Do you see that comment? Do you see that meme I put in Facebook? You know, you're all wrong. It's like one person, you know, addressing about 10 million. It doesn't matter.
So that's
if I'm right, I'm right. Well, yeah, it's pretty good.
Yeah.
So do you trust Vivek Swamy?
Yeah, I trust Ben Swamy from what I've read so far.
Okay.
But I don't think, like Josh say, I don't think he's going to – he's making a show and he's putting his name out there. He's a young face. We need young faces today to attract the younger people. That's one of the things that I emphasize is that information in the young people.
I got no problem with that. I think, you know, I purposely get young people on the show just for that reason. In fact, I was hoping Amber comes back sometime. But I love having young people on the show.
Oh, where is she?
She's in college. I do too.
Do you know my favorite thing that Ramaswamy said in public?
Please share.
Platform?
Okay, go for it.
Okay, let's do some arm circles right now. We're about to burn a calorie. He said when he was talking to Tim Pool, he said that he thinks that for people to, like, because the vote is not a right, it's a privilege, just like driving. He said that if people are going to vote, they need to earn it in some way. And he said there may be some civil service requirements in the future.
Didn't I say that in Starship Troopers?
Yeah, I know what you're doing. Yes. And that's actually what they compared it to on the show.
Service.
But no, you're not going to have to hop into a friggin' Starship Trooper, flight to
go fight. Do you want to learn more? Josh, do you want to learn more?
You're not going to have to go to Clean Dathu. All right. You got to, clean up
planet P,
trash on
the
side of the
planet.
Road.
Well, that's kind of a good suggestion there. There's some legitimacy to voting being a privilege and not a right, because the way it works now, you hurt so many groups of people into a particular direction when it comes to voting, and they have given it no thought.
Now, voting here's my take on this, and these are both really – you're both making really good points. But voting should – just because something's a right doesn't mean you have to do it, okay? And the problem with voting is it's become a mandate.
Let me finish.
Okay. So the whole point is that take gun rights, for example. We have the right to keep and bear arms, but you don't have to carry a gun, and if you can't afford one, the government doesn't give you one. So in order to exercise the right, there are certain things you have to do. If they're in a living, you have to be able to purchase a gun. You have to be an age, which should be 18 for everything, but besides all the arbitrary stuff. But you don't automatically get to exercise it. Same thing with free speech. You can scream and yell all you want, and that's free. But if you want to, exercise your free speech on a computer, you got to buy the computer. The government doesn't give you one just so you can exercise free speech. Voting is the same way. There should be no Herculean efforts made to get anybody to vote. If they're in a nursing home and can't get to the polls, you don't vote. Okay. If you can't understand what's on the form because, you're in a nursing home, you don't vote. If you're out of the country, and you're on vacation, isn't that great? Okay. If you can do an absentee ballot, that's all right. But for the most part, these Herculean exceptions, you don't vote. Ballot harvesting, illegal. Mail-in voting, illegal. I don't mind early voting, but go to the polls yourself. Sign in. Have your ID checked. There are certain criteria. Just as the same thing as you do a background check for guns, you should do a background check for voting. It's the same thing. Make it a right. I wouldn't stop anybody from voting. As an American citizen, of course, illegals can't vote, and we've already had that discussion. But American citizens have the right to vote. It is a right. But a right is just something that is a firewall of prior
right.
restraint. Hold on, let me finish. Believe me, I'll give you a chance. But a right, let me just finish this point on rights. A right is a firewall. A right is what the government cannot touch ahead of time. Okay, the government cannot touch your right to keep and bear arms. Government cannot touch your right to free speech ahead of time. Now, once you say something or once you take an action with a gun, that's a different thing. Then you fall under statutory law, which is subordinate to the Constitution, and there are legal and illegal speech things, like you can't threaten a public official, because that's a felony. All right, you can't use guns, to carjack. That's a felony. All right, but the right beforehand to keep and bear is absolute. The right to speak beforehand is the same thing. The right to vote, sure. However, there's no Herculean effort that needs to be taken. But that's why it's a right. Josh, your turn. Then we'll get to Pianki.
It's not actually a right to vote. If you go to prison for a violent crime, you don't have the right to vote. It's actually a
okay. That's due process, though. That's removing a right for due process. You can't bring a gun to prison either.
Okay, I'm saying that the concept of the right to vote is for a responsible citizen to be able to choose the path forward for your society.
Yeah, that's not so the concept is great, but that's not what the Constitution says. That's not what the law says.
I love that. What does the Constitution say about the right to vote anywhere in the Constitution?
It doesn't. But what I'm saying it doesn't give the government permission to take away, your right to vote through due process either. So there's certain things that are said and are not said. State constitutions are different. So I think if you're looking for a right to vote, you're going to find it in the state constitutions.
Yeah, but there is no right to vote. It's a privilege.
Remember,
it's a privilege to vote.
No, I disagree with you. It's a right to vote. But I also think driving is a right, too,
because
we have a right to travel.
I know. Well, you can go into the Universal Declaration of Human Rights for that.
I got nothing to do with it. No. I'm just saying that rights, how can you have a free society if you can't have the right to travel freely?
A right is your ability to do something
without government interference
by your creator that does not cause harm to another. Your ability to speak is your right because so long as how is that not true?
Well, because the Second Amendment, if I'm exercising self-defense, I'm probably going to cause harm to another person, but I'm going to save myself because I'm the good guy.
What? No. If you are using – no, you cannot use a right to detriment another person. You can't infringe on another person's right by using your right. You can't harm another by using a firearm.
Okay, we're gonna get off in a rabbit hole here. No, I don't want to do that. All right, and besides, I want to get back to Ukraine anyway. I got a big article I want to get to.
Yeah.
But so let's get back to Pianki. So where do you stand so far? And then I got another article for us as we return back on track.
I agree with your analogy on that. Great.
Okay.
It's a good one. And Josh, your point you should have made was that that right is delegated to the states to decide whether a prisoner or not can vote. But also, when you talk about privilege, Barbara Jordan, the congressperson from the state of Texas, said that immigration is a privilege and not a right.
Absolutely.
So it just depends on what you're talking about.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But I still, and I've argued this several times. Now, here's the thing. Just one more point on driving. You know, they say you need a driver's license to enforce traffic rules and all that kind of stuff. No, you don't. We enforce all kinds of rules without having a license. You know, parking tickets are enforced, but you don't, you know, they're just enforced on you personally. I mean, all kinds of laws are enforced upon you without having a specific license. So they can enforce speed limits, they can enforce parking fines, they can enforce everything without a driver's license and do just fine. You know, as long as you have ID, which we have to have anyway, that's how that works. So there's no reason for a driver's license, none, except to control
you. You know where they don't have driver's licenses and speed limits?
Where?
Really? Okay, no, it's Indian
where?
Territories. The Indian Territories. They might have speed limits, but they don't have driver's licenses. You can drive around without license plates or registration or anything.
That's cool. Maybe I should take a look at that. All right. So I found this in Newsweek just to change things around a little bit. Now, the article is a little dated, but it's fascinating. This is from December 6th of 2022, so just last year. So talking about 6 months ago. And so the war was going on because the war started about a year ago. And it's Newsweek, which I found fascinating. Michael G. Fuller and David H. Rundell. Don't know who these guys are. F-O-E-L-L-E-R and R-U-N-D-E-L-L. And so it says, lessons from the U.S. Civil War show why Ukraine can't win. Now, why this wasn't massive news across the country, the only reason I can think of is because we're a colony of Ukraine and we have to keep giving them all our resources so they can fight forever and keep our military government fascist complex rich. So here's what.
Yeah, that's obviously a terrible interpretation of what that was. But OK, go ahead.
Well, a terrible interpretation of what?
Us giving money is because of the regime in power in D.C. We shouldn't be giving money to those people. Obviously, we can give the Donbass and the Crimea to Russia.
It's not ours to give.
Really happy.
It's not ours to give or protect.
I know. It has nothing. I know it has nothing to do with us. We shouldn't be giving them billions of dollars. We shouldn't be giving them.
Yeah, we shouldn't even be there.
Yeah.
Well, the only reason they're at war is because we're allowing them to fight. And I made this point at the very beginning of the show. If we were not supplying Ukraine with billions of dollars and all of our arms, they couldn't wage war. And if they couldn't wage war, they'd have to go for a negotiated peace, which is what we knew was going to happen anyway. Dr. Peter Pryor told us about this 6 months before the war even started. We all knew this. All right, let me read the article.
Can I throw a gas-covered stick on that fire?
I'm about to mute you, but go ahead.
If Ukraine is allowed to join NATO, we should exit NATO.
We should exit NATO.
No longer need to.
All right, we should exit NATO anyway, but let me talk about that after
you know, that's a good point. That's a good point. If Russia joined NATO, then what's the need for the expenses we use in the defense industry?
Russia will never join NATO. Russia actually tried to resurrect the Warsaw Pact. Well, why would they join NATO? The whole reason NATO was formed was to oppose Russia.
If they joined NATO, then all guns would stop being pointed at them.
Yeah, but they can't join NATO.
The entire formation of NATO was for Europe and America to protect.
Yeah.
Borderlands.
That's why Warsaw That's why they formed the Warsaw Pact. All right, gentlemen, hold up.
The Warsaw Pact exist?
No, it collapsed when the Soviet Union collapsed. All right, hold up, gentlemen. All right, so here's the article. Here's what it says, because this is what I want to focus on, is the fact this war cannot be won. It says, during the early years of America's Civil War, President Abraham Lincoln sought a limited conflict against people he still regarded as fellow countrymen and with whom he sought reconciliation. Only after 3 years of stalemate did he turn to unconditional surrender Grant, that'd be General Grant, who in turn unleashed General William Tecumseh Sherman to make Georgia howl and help bring the war to its decisively violent conclusion. Russian President Vladimir Putin waited only 6 months before switching from a special military operation to full-scale war against Ukraine. Putin's initial assault was limited to barely 150,000 troops. He expected a quick victory followed by negotiations on his principal concerns. Of course, that's what should have happened. And those were Russian control of Crimea, Ukrainian neutrality, in other words, not in NATO, and autonomy for the Russian population of the Donbass, but he was wrong. Putin had not counted on Ukraine's stiff resistance or the West's massive military and economic intervention. Faced with a new situation, Putin changed his strategy. Now he is about to unleash his own General Sherman and make Ukraine howl. Okay, so this is 6 months ago, so this is already going on. This is the spring offensive. Then it says, last month Putin gave General... All right, go ahead. Quick comment. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, yes, absolutely, that was going to happen. If you look at the military history of Russia, they have to protect their borders, and they use that with mass. The majority of their population is in the eastern part of their country, and it's almost impossible to infiltrate during certain seasons.
That's why
Germans failed. That's why the French failed. Yeah.
Yeah. Germans failed twice, Bismarck and Hitler. The French failed under Napoleon. A bunch of folks failed. Genghis Khan failed. Russia gets too cold. I mean, everybody knows that. You fail in Afghanistan, you fail in Russia. There are just certain absolutes in the world, although people keep trying. All right. But the point of this is, knowing that this war could never have been won, which all of us knew, you know, going into this, why would they do it? See, that's the real question. But let me get back to the article, because those are good points, though. It says, last month, Putin gave General Sergei Surovikin. Now, his name's going to pop up again, which is fascinating. General Sergei Surovikin. So remember his name. Overall command of Russia's war in the Ukraine. Surovikin comes from the technologically sophisticated aerospace forces, but has fought on the ground in Afghanistan, Chechnya, and Syria. So this guy's no dummy, right? Where he is credited with saving the Assad regime, and that would be against Hillary Clinton and ISIS and running guns through Benghazi and all that stuff. That's for another show. Then it says, Surovikin has stated publicly that there will be no half measures in Ukraine. Instead, he has begun to methodically destroy Ukraine's infrastructure with precision missile attacks. He says armies need one of the things he's done, and you got a thing here, it's a picture in the article, and it's all over my Facebook, right? A pedestrian walks down the street during a power cut in downtown Odessa, December 5th. So he was already cutting the power. You've heard about the power plants that have been destroyed. Like I say, this guy's no dummy. He says, the article says, armies need railroads. And while Sherman, it's back to the Civil War, while Sherman systematically tore up the tracks leading to Atlanta, Surovikin is destroying the electricity grid which powers Ukraine's railroads. This has left Ukrainian cities cold and dark, but Surovikin seems to agree with Sherman that, quote, war is cruelty and you cannot refine it. Russia has now put its economy on war footing, calling up the reserves and assembled hundreds of thousands of troops, including both conscripts and volunteers. Conscripts are those who are drafted, for those that don't know the word. This army is equipped with Russia's most sophisticated weapons, and contrary to much Western reporting, is far from demoralized. Ukraine, on the other hand, has exhausted its armories and is totally dependent on Western military support to continue the war. So in other words, without us, there'd be no war. That's the key for me. Then he says, as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, or Milktoast as I call him, noted last week, Ukraine has done about all it can. And this is December. This is 6 months ago. Then it says, once Ukraine's rich black soil has firmly frozen, a massive Russian onslaught will commence. In fact, it has already begun. This is the spring offensive that started a few months ago. At the important transportation hub of Bakhmut, which we've heard about, which has become something of a Ukrainian Verdun, which is a place in World War I where literally millions of soldiers on both sides died. He says, we expect Bakhmut to fall and predict that without much more Western support, Russia will recapture Kharkov, Kherson, and the remainder of the Donbass by next summer. Well, we're now in next summer, so let's see what happens. But they're tearing up the Ukraine. They're taking away their ability to wage war, and the Ukraine is totally dependent on us. That's why this war can't be won. So what are we doing?
That is not a likely dependence that one would want to have, seeking independence. But we said this in the beginning that Ukraine could not defeat Russia. That's, people that had those thoughts was delusional.
Mm-hmm. So the question is, Pianki, and I'll ask Josh the same question, do we engage in wars to win, or do we engage in wars to spend money and keep them going, knowing that they can't be won?
You are engaging in wars, like Josh mentioned, I believe, it's for the money. And Greg and Josh, the money is a boomerang. You throw it toward Ukraine or any other contender, and it comes back around into the coffers of U.S. politicians, your warmongers.
Yes, the military-industrial government. I would say the military-industrial government complex, the banks, the military contractors, and the government all make money off this war. This is basically a business.
Yeah, but they make it directly.
Yeah.
They make it directly. But indirectly, when it goes over to the Ukraine, it's aid. Nobody knows where those dollars, where and how they are spent. They come back around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're not even
I agree with that. I'm sorry, I wasn't trying to interrupt.
That's okay. No, you're fine. Go ahead.
I agree with that, except for, yes, I agree with the boomerang. We throw a buttload of money out, and it doesn't really come back to us, though, does it? It comes back to people like Joe Biden. It comes back
to
people who Raytheon and Halliburton.
The military industrial it's the military industrial government complex. So the people that make money are the bankers that loan money to the government. You know, the military people that make the arms, because now they have to make more arms. So they're all running to Congress saying, we're out of bullets. We've got to make more bullets. You've got to give us more money. And they're absolutely right.
Did you see that?
You know,
did you just see that?
Go ahead.
Did you
let's
just
go,
see that thing
Josh.
That I'm sorry.
That's okay. No,
there was a NASA pressure regulator for their large vehicles that move stuff like the bigger materials around the airfields, and they paid like $348 for it. And then that same pressure regulator, when it came to the military, they paid $10,000 per piece.
Of course.
So,
yeah, but that's called stealing. That's the $600 toilet seat was the but they do that on purpose. That's part of the padding that goes in so everybody makes more money. But
that
let me
was
ask you a question
back in the '80s about toilet seats.
Well, that's why I said it. That's why I mentioned it. You know, showing our age again, as Josh would say. But here's a question: What is a legitimate reason for war? Well, let's get to the basics. What is a viable reason for us to go to war?
Nowadays, there is none, really.
Okay, so let's go, Pianki, then Josh. So, Pianki, there is none. There's no place where we really have to go to war. I tend to agree, because it's all done with hypersonic missiles, a real war. So let's talk about a real war. The last real war was World War II, all right? We had nations that were pretty much, you know, at least relatively well matched up. You had stalemate in Europe. You had Germany, you know, versus England and France on one side. And then they made the mistake of attacking Russia. That was their downfall. Germany probably could have defeated England and Russia, England and France, whereas they couldn't have done it in World War One. But they could have done it in World War II and held Europe until Europe rebelled and eventually brought them down again, because that's what happens. But they're fairly well matched. So the United States came in and tipped the balance. Russia tipped the balance on the other side. But were we in danger of losing our country in World War II? Let me talk about Japan in a minute. Were we in danger of losing our country from Germany? Yes or no?
Well, I don't know if Germany had that ambition to come across the ocean. Now, Japan could have done some damage.
Yeah, let's talk about Japan in a minute.
Damage.
Let's get Germany. What could Germany have done to us? Because there's a couple things that I know. Josh, I want to get your thing. What could Germany have done to us in World War II?
Me?
Yeah, you.
Oh, yeah. No, what Germany could have done to us in World War II, they could have completely cut off supply lines in the Atlantic, which I think they
that would have
did pretty successfully.
Yeah, well, they tried
to do
U-boats. Right. Okay, but they couldn't have cut off our supplies. They couldn't have cut us off from Canada or Mexico or our trade routes or the Panama Canal.
Yeah,
they could have blown out the Panama Canal.
We were trying to send supplies, and they definitely messed that up pretty bad.
But that was to help Britain. Right. So in other words, Germany could not. All right. Hold on a second. Stop. So Germany could not have mounted a naval attack on the United States that would have affected our country, invaded us. They could not have brought a land war to us. They could have not brought an air war to us. I mean, they had bombers that were planned that were going to be able to bomb the United States. But it wasn't like they would have, you know, caused us to lose our country to Germany. That wasn't going to happen. They could have bombed the Panama Canal. I'm surprised they didn't, actually, or blown it up. But they had plans with Mexico. They were trying to make Mexico an ally to invade the United States through Mexico. So that was a viable plan. We stopped it. Now let's talk about Japan. Could Japan have occupied and controlled the United States in World War II?
No, Germany couldn't have done anything either.
I agree with you.
I'm talking about Germany. Just go Japan.
Germany was enslaved in Mexico in the Mexican-American War. That's not really known. But you're absolutely right. The United States was self-contained, self-dependent at that time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They didn't have to depend on anybody. And Josh was right. The U-boats were disrupting supplies to our allies during that war. But today, there's no need for no war today. Really, there's no need. And you made another mention, Josh, when you said Raytheon. When U.S. generals come out of service, they go to work, a lot of them, not area, and sit on the boards of these defense contractors.
Right.
And Austin sat on the board of Raytheon, from my knowledge. And now we've got Stinger missiles going to the Ukraine. U.S. is buying them from Raytheon. They're being sent to the Ukraine along with aid, and some of those aid dollars is coming back around with the boomerang effect.
What a surprise.
That's not a boomerang, my friend. That's so directly linked. It's not a boomerang. Right. It's you serve a term and then you get paid when you retire. It's the same people that are politicians and then they become what's that stuff where you're over there trying to convince people to spend money on your causes?
Lobbying. A lobbyist.
Yeah, you become a lobbyist after you become a politician.
Okay.
Yeah,
let's
get
back on track.
Yeah.
All right. So let's get back on track with war here, because I want to stick with war as a topic. And so Japan, could they? Because I have a follow up question. So could they have invaded the United States and occupied us? They could have destroyed the Panama Canal. That would have sabotaged things. They could have, you know, made hell of the West Coast if we didn't stop them at Midway. They could have destroyed much of Australia if we didn't stop them at Coral Sea. But could they have occupied and controlled the United States?
No.
And they said it themselves. Behind every blade of grass, there's a gun.
There'd be some damn redneck with a rifle taking on those Japanese soldiers. Yeah, we'd be done. We'd be dying. It'd be all over, right? Just like the Swiss and the Nazis.
I was thinking about making bog radio, blade of grass radio. Thank you, sir.
It would be funny, yeah. All right, so the point is, now, here's the follow-up question. Were these wars worth fighting against Japan and Germany?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah,
so
there were wars fighting.
Okay, so there are wars that are worth fighting that do not necessarily imperil the United States. And I agree. I agree that World War II was worth fighting. World War I was not. But World War I basically caused World War II, and we can talk about that later too. So given that we agree that there are wars that are worth fighting, there are battles that are worth fighting that do not necessarily imperil the United States, let's go on further. Because I think World War II was the last such war. World War II was fought to end evil. I mean, pure evil in the world. And I agree with that. Hitler and Hirohito had to be stopped. Tojo? Yeah. Hitler and Tojo had to be stopped. Okay. And they were. Cost them millions of lives. We'll talk about the atomic bomb another time, too. All right. Let's move on. Korea. Did Korea need to be fought by us?
Yes.
Well, you created a strong ally with South Korea, and also a market Heck, I'm talking on South Korea's products right now.
What if we'd insisted that Korea could not possibly exist
if we didn't intervene?
Okay, but what if we'd insisted that Korea not be split? We wouldn't have had a war.
How could you have made that happen?
Because it was done by the UN. We controlled the UN. We could have vetoed it. Oops.
Yeah, but
I'm so
happy. North Korea would agree with it because you had factions there between the two.
Yeah, okay. All right. I don't want to get too much into the history, but the point is that the Korea didn't have to be split. In other words, I'm looking for alternatives. So let's go to Vietnam. I'm trying to find legitimate wars after World War II. Was Vietnam a legitimate war for us to fight?
Yes and no. Yes.
Okay. Why?
The influence of communism was growing rapidly, and it wasn't just about Vietnam. It was about Cambodia and Laos,
Domino
too.
Theory. Right, got the domino theory. Okay, so Vietnam is now communist, so we failed. Okay, the Korea is still split, and they've never officially ended the war.
The North side wasn't.
Okay, so wait a minute. All right, so but the point is that that these wars are the last war that was won, where the outcome was as we desired, was World War II. So let's go to the Gulf Wars.
Oh, come on, man. I was born during those. Don't do that to me.
Necessary for our survival? Would you have fought in a Gulf War thinking that the United States was imperiled by Iraq?
Gulf War is the same ideology of let's send this military equipment over, mm-hmm. and, you know, we get a part of the profit. That's the ideology of the politician.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. These are military-industrial complex wars. These are not real wars. These are not against countries that imperil our safety. These are not against Saddam Hussein was evil, but there's lots of evil people out there. The question is whether it's an evil person that we have to stop. See, that's the part that we forget. And just because they're evil doesn't mean we have to stop them. Doesn't mean we can't help. Doesn't mean we can't go through the United Nations if you want. Doesn't mean we can't do a bunch of things. But do we have to go to war? See, that's the question. Is that the only solution? Does China go to war with countries they take over? No, they do it economically. So as Pianki said, war is not always the answer. I think we're stuck in a war mentality. We're stuck in a 50-year-old war mentality when China is using modern cyber warfare. They're using economic warfare. They're not firing guns anywhere. They're building up a huge military. But if they take over Taiwan, are they going to have to go in shooting? Or can they just blockade them, cut them off? Do a cyber hack, cut them off industrially and every other way so that they have no choice but to be.
Well, you know, another thing, too, uh-huh. China uses North Korea as a buffer,
mm-hmm. yep.
as Russia does, as we do with Mexico and the other mm-hmm. countries. So they do have that in mind because they didn't have North Korea as a buffer. They would be open there on the sea.
Hmm. Are we at war in Korea?
Yes. Yeah. You know that there has never been a peace established. The DMZ exists for a reason. Not necessarily we are at war, but war is still existing between North and South Korea.
Right.
It's been going on for over 60 years.
Right, and yet Trump shook hands with Kim Jong-un and actually walked into North Korea.
He walked across the DMZ like a gentleman with no security into North Korea.
And he walked back out again.
Don't,
how about that?
Yeah, I know. And I, you know what? I don't even care about politics when it comes to that. The balls uh-huh. that it takes for one man to walk uh-huh. across the DMZ into North Korea. I don't care what your political affiliations are. Dude, uh-huh. that was some John Wayne.
That's serious
stuff.
Cojones. Yeah, no, I agree with you. But the question is it worth fighting a war there? If North Korea invades South Korea, is it up to us to save South Korea? Can we afford to? In other words, have we extended? Go ahead, Josh. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say I'm going to go ahead and stay in the same metric that I do not want to fight people because most of the time the people that we're fighting are people that agree with us on more than we disagree. It's just a bunch of idiots in politics and all this nonsense, and they don't even agree with them either. So, no, I do not want to kill my fellow man.
So have we solved?
I think that's a terrible way.
Have we solved Iraq's problems with our Gulf Wars?
Iraq. No, they still have their faction.
How about that?
Are you telling me they don't have more water parks now?
Hold on, Josh. I want to hear from you. We got 5 minutes before Josh. But we're going to get to Jonathan in 5 minutes. That's why I'm kind of rushing things along. Pianchi?
Greg, if we didn't have the monies that we have going through these militaries, could you imagine how better off the people would be?
You know, I made that argument on Facebook. Someone called me. They said that's a stupid argument. It's been used a bunch of times before. And it's like, no, it's a good argument. It's absolutely valid. I agree with you. If we didn't spend the $7 trillion in Afghanistan and the $5 trillion in Iraq or however much we spent, the trillions of dollars since Korea, and I'm talking about the reason I went through that little exercise is because I'm saying these are unjustified wars. These are not even wars. They're not declared wars. They're illegal wars, according to the Constitution. And yet we've lost trillions of dollars. We could have, I'm sure, a national health voucher choice program where people could where people wouldn't go bankrupt just because they can't afford medical care or medical insurance. That would have been a far better use of the money than any of those wars, Korea, Vietnam, Iraq or Afghanistan or now Ukraine. You've got five wars that have taken trillions and trillions of dollars out of our infrastructure, out of our education, out of our health, out of our economy, out of inflation, out of our savings, out of retirements, out of investment, out of individual productive capital, venture capital. Nothing good has come out of this except for the military, industrial, banking, fascist cabal. Those are the only people who benefit from all these wars. That's the problem. I agree with Pianchi.
Well, you said that's true.
Yeah. Go ahead, Pianchi.
No, that's true. And, you know, here's another thing, too.
Mm-hmm.
If you do away with the war industry, then you're going to have a lot of people with technical knowledge that needs to have that applied someplace else. United States.
What do we do after World War II? Yeah. What do we do after World War II?
Yeah.
We invented the 57 Chevy. Dude, we've got great consumer ideas out there. Besides, I want a jet. Have a nice, affordable carbon fiber jet. Under $100,000. Let's rebuild our general aviation.
Chevy with 327 engine. Absolutely right.
So that's what we did after
World
War II.
Do it again, Greg.
Yeah, we didn't build. After World War II, we stopped building P-51s and we started building 57 Chevys. Good trade. Okay. So in other words, the people, I think you're on a really good point here that the engineers, that the people that build things, whether it's civilian or military, they just like building things. And you think the Wright brothers made the airplane for the military?
You know what the next frontier is going to be with that knowledge, that technology?
Uh-huh. Right.
It's going to be space.
Uh-huh.
Greg Pingless, Asteroid Exploration Company. Josh, mineral extraction from asteroid 245568.
Action Radio becomes Action Air, you know, Action Radio Airlines.
Aerospace, yeah.
You heard of Virgin
Space
Atlantic?
Exploration,
now we're going to Virgin Aerospace.
Action Radio.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah, Virgin Atlantic will become Virgin Aerospace. Action Radio, rocket ship. Well, we're going to have Action Radio 1. I'm going to have my own jet. We're just waiting to break through the censorship. But yeah, but that's the thing. The engineers will build, I think they're just as happy, probably happier to build consumer things, you know, than they are to build military stuff. But a lot of military spending has come out really well, like the internet, contrary to Al Gore. The internet was a military application of computers to connect NORAD. That's how it got started. Well, once computers learned how to talk to each other, you know, we got the whole internet for the rest of us. Look at the space program, too. In fact, this is something interesting. If you ever do a study of the things that come out of the space program, what do you call those things? Those fire warning things? Smoke alarms.
Yeah, smoke alarms, memory foam mattresses.
Smoke alarm. Yep. Okay. Velcro came out of the space program. Defogging agents, you know, the things that you spray on your glasses or your windshields that stop the fogging, the space program. So many things have come out of the space program that are now consumer goods. You know, a lot of military things have come out. A lot of military technology ends up in the civilian world. I'm sure the glass cockpit. Well, you may know this. Pianchi, I don't know this one. The glass cockpit. You know, we switched over from, what do they call them, vacuum instruments to computerized glass screens. Weren't those first done with military airplanes before civilians?
Yeah, it's called Gorilla Glass.
Oh, okay. That's
on your phone. Yeah.
Huh, can I introduce a different concept?
Yeah, you got 2 minutes.
Okay. Literally, when people were comfortable, we actually innovated the most when we did not feel like we were in constant conflict with other people. We came up with a bunch of ridiculous stuff.
So when was that? When were we not in conflicts? Okay. So when were we not in Vietnam, Korea, the Gulf War, Afghanistan, or Ukraine? When have we actually been at peace with no
I'm talking about
globalist war?
I thought I had 2 minutes there, Gregory.
No, we do. We do until Jonathan calls. As soon as Jonathan calls, we're gonna switch over to what he wants to talk about. But when have we?
Okay.
It's actually really good. You've asked a really good question. When have we not been at war? And what happened during that time?
I'm talking about when Americans on American soil felt most comfortable, where we weren't going to be attacked. That's when our innovation rose.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
so
let's start with World War II. So between World War II and Korea, it was 1945 to 1950. Okay, between Korea and
we were never worried about Koreans touching.
Okay,
American
just follow me through on the timeline. Follow me through on the timeline. So you're talking about the years where we were not at war. Okay, 45 to 50. Okay.
No. The threat of attack on American soil.
No, stop that. No. Just listen to what I'm saying. When were we not at war? And did that? How did that affect consumer goods and innovation? So 45 to 50, we're not at war. 53 to, I'm not sure exactly when Vietnam started.
58,
like the 59.
Early 60s.
Let's say 1960.
Oh, really?
Let's say 1960, just for the sake of it, because I know we had advisors in there pretty early. Then there was Eisenhower. So let's go 53 to 57. So that's only 4 years. All right. So
you
Vietnam went
another
into,
example.
Well, man, let me finish this because I think this is interesting. So the peace years are 40 to 45, 53 to 57. Okay. So then Vietnam went to 74, right? Or 75, 75. So when did the Gulf War start? So from 75 until 90?
No, it was early 80. It was like 86.
No, because that would have been Reagan. The Gulf War was under Bush.
It had to at least – no, the latest would have been 88.
All right, let's say 88. So then we actually had – our greatest peace was from the end of Vietnam at 75 until 1988. That's 13 years. And what happened then? Man, the 80s hair metal, you know, great cars. We actually had a good time then, right? Now, from the Gulf War – Jonathan's on the line too, so he's listening, wondering what the hell we're talking about. It's kind of funny. So from the Gulf War, so 1988 until present day, we've been at war somewhere. Iraq, Afghanistan, Ukraine. Have we had any peace?
And you know, when you talk about communists, you talk about a group, another group of business entrepreneurs, people that's going against the Western entrepreneurs, business people. And they're trying to get into undeveloped countries because they're a source for business. And, you know, one of the greatest – the goal to show you what private innovation can do in order to stymie the warmongers, look what Elon Musk have created when he has the ability to take that high-lift rocket and bring it back and land it on a pad where it can be reused again. You don't have to buy it.
I think that's wonderful. But here's the thing, though, as we're talking about, if we did not have the trillions upon trillions of dollars of drain from Iraq 1, Iraq 2, Afghanistan, and now Ukraine, if we didn't have that drain, just think how much further along the space program would be with all that venture capital going to private uses. So the greatest –
Greg.
Well, thank you. I want to focus on this one period because I think it's fascinating. So if we take 75 to 88 – okay, I graduated high school in 77. These were fabulous years in this country. We were happy. We had hair metal. You know, we had Ronald Reagan. It was morning in America. We were proud. We had new cars. We had new innovations. We were free. Energy was in pretty decent shape. You know, the economy was pretty decent.
A little
the Reagan recovery.
Dash of Cold War. A little dash of Cold War.
But there wasn't much. No, Reagan basically ended the Cold War because he outspent Russia. But the Cold War was never a shooting war. I'm talking about an actual shooting war. Yeah, we built our military. And the Cold War is an interesting case. We should take that separately. I want to do that another time. But during the time of prosperity, I'll make Jonathan's line live so he can join in this. But during our time of prosperity, 1975 to 1988, those were really good years in this country. And I think one of the biggest reasons those were really good years in this country is we weren't spending trillions of dollars in some stupid war to make our military, industrial, banking, government, fascist complex rich. Let's go Josh Pianchi, then I'll bring in Jonathan. Josh, what do you think? Does that make sense? That's when you were born.
Yeah, that makes sense. I was born in a different era.
When were you born? How old are you? Are you Gen X or what? 90. You're a millennial.
Come on.
You're a millennial?
Okay, you know what? Hey, I'm not going to insult you, sir. Yes, I'm.
You just called me sir. Wait, what, am I old? Pianchi, what do you think?
God damn it, I'm going to call you sir. No,
ma'am, okay, fine. Hold on, Josh.
Both of y'all are kids. You, Josh, you, Greg, are kids.
And this man came out of a crypt.
Okay, all right. So, Pianchi, 1975 to 1988, you were there when I was there. You know, we were both alive and adults and mature somewhat. I was in my 20s. Weren't those great years when we weren't at war?
Yes, always great years when people are not at war because it helps to create economy. It helps to create money flow, the ability to exchange of goods and the transfer of money from one to the other. You can see it going down the street. If you choose to grab it, you can grab it. If not, let it go until the next bunch comes through.
So when are we going to stop these mad people? When are we going to stop these insane, irrational, greedy, avaricious, you know, horrible folks from keeping us in a constant state of war?
I just want to point out that you are literally absolutely affirming exactly what I was saying before. The threat of the other is the reason that we do better. It doesn't matter if we're actually in conflict violently with them. It's the threat of the other that makes us better.
Disagree. I think it's the lack of threat that makes us better. Jonathan, let's get to some legal stuff. Let's talk January 6th or anything that's going on. Or if you want to add to this discussion, we've been going crazy. This has been fun.
So my weighing in is it's morning in America.
Ooh.
All over America. People are great. People are getting up and going to work again. And now if people don't know.
Wait a minute. I need some music for you. Hang on, Jonathan. Jonathan, just give me a second here. Let me see if I can find this real quick. Here we go. So start over again.
It's morning in America. There you go. All over America, people are getting up and going to work again, which was actually an issue. If you don't know the Ronald Reagan, it's probably one of the most famous campaign. Well, should
keep going. The music's still playing. Jonathan, use the music. Jonathan, use the music.
I don't remember it all.
Make it up.
I don't remember it all word for word. I just know the opening.
Improvise. Come on, Jonathan.
America's proud again. We are, rebuilding our country. And, brought to you by Reagan Bush, 1984. One of the most momentous campaign ads, probably long forgotten, so I can't say it's famous, but momentous.
I was about to say Jonathan for Dictator of Alaska.
Dictator of Alaska?
I'm gonna let you go, okay?
This is for us boomers. What's your name, Greg? We like old timer boomers, right? But the thing is what you're saying is like the bounce back from the Reagan years, of course, was one of the most amazing, staggering things, and it led up to. The Soviet Union didn't actually collapse until starting 1989. But we had a lot to do with it, obviously.
Well, a question came up earlier that the Warsaw Pact, I believe, collapsed when the Soviet Union collapsed, right? Because they couldn't back them anymore. They simply didn't have the money.
Yes.
So at that point, NATO should have dissolved, and we wouldn't be in this mess today. But NATO did just the opposite. They thought, this is a marketing opportunity. We can build our power. We can get more countries, more money out of the U.S., defend more and more different nations, and bring in this big mutual defense pact, all the while charging the U.S. to pay for it because they're stupid. They'll do it. And then we're in this mess right now with Ukraine.
And you can't leave out the key component is that money comes back around into the coffers of the people that's promoting it.
Let me address that in just a little bit. Let's get back to the main thing, though, because Jonathan has expertise in this area. That's why I'm asking it. So the Soviet Union collapses, 89, glasnost, Gorbachev, all that kind of stuff. Warsaw Pact collapses, too. Why didn't we just get out of NATO? Or was it the money? Was
because
the money too
money
much of an attractive force? Okay, all right. So let's want Jonathan's opinion.
Well, I don't know. I mean, the thing is I do recall, as what we're seeing now, that, you know, people were running around Washington, D.C., around the conservative think tanks, saying that, you know, that it was the Soviet Union is just faking. This is like, you know, they're it's a head fake. They're going to come back and attack and all kinds of stuff like that. They're just trying to get us to get our guard down. I don't know. I think nobody ever raised the issue, which was the funny thing, is that, the question never came up. So I don't know, you know, what the thinking, you know, what it would have been, but it is kind of funny that the thing is that the truth is, like I said, I was at High Frontier, which was the think tank that came up with missile defense, with Reagan's missile defense program. Then I went to an arm of the Heritage Foundation, and we worked with a lot of those things. but actually, it was the Eastern Bloc that collapsed first. It was really the Soviet Union proper could not maintain the disintegration of its power in Eastern Europe and around it.
Were you there for Lech Walesa and Solidarity in Poland at all? Were you there at that time?
Well, I wasn't in Poland, but I was watching it. Yes.
Okay.
And we had a Pope who stood up for freedom.
Right.
He was, you know, a Polish Pope, and he was against the Soviet involvement in that.
Yeah.
And
I actually saw him in Rome. I was in the Vatican for Easter Sunday when I did my Europe trip, so I got to see John Paul speak. It was fabulous. Everybody loved him.
I was a missionary and taught business in Latvia, and I had a boss in the Department of Education who was Estonian. I've referenced her, how her, not by name, but by her, mother and relatives, I think, in Estonia were criticizing the government, and the phone operator interrupted and yelled at them.
Yep. You told me that story.
Interrupted their phone call, which is kind of like what's going on with social media today. Mm-hmm. And they had hands across, they all across the Baltic states of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. The whole population held hands across the entire peninsula, which is huge in opposition to Soviet occupation of their country. And they actually had a gunfire in Riga. They showed us the bullets in the buildings. So it really started from the exterior, you know, from the borders of the Soviet bloc.
We have listeners in Latvia, and actually we have listeners in Belarus too, which is kind of interesting. That's right there. We don't have any listeners in Ukraine, surprisingly.
You have listeners in Latvia. Well, let me say Labdien, which is good day. Is about all I know Paul Diaz and things like that, but which is please. But anyway, no, that's some brave folks.
We have Cuba too. Cuba and Vietnam.
Vietnam
is always been listening to us, and we have Cuba listeners. I mean, Cuba's been there for months. It's amazing. Anyway, let me ask you, I want to change subjects a little bit here. Social media, you just mentioned that. I'm confused as to what's going on. I remember I spent 3 days going over Judge Doty's injunction on the Brandon insurrection, that they cannot communicate with social media and continue their violations of our First Amendment rights. And then I heard about this three-judge panel. In fact, I sent you the article probably too late for you to look at it this morning before the show. Saying that there's a stay on that injunction. And then I'm hearing that it's back. I don't know where it stands. Do you know where it stands right now? What's going on with that?
Well, okay. Let me try to back up here.
Sure.
A lot of these things someone files a lawsuit. And then early in the process, somebody files an injunction. And the lawsuit's not over. The lawsuit's, you know, just barely beginning. And they want to get a standstill, you know, hold, you know, preserve the status quo. But the lawsuit hasn't, you know, come anywhere close to being to playing its course. So they got a temporary injunction against the government, a whole bunch of government agencies, not all, and with some very disturbing exceptions, really.
Mm-hmm.
But it indicates, you know, in order to get an injunction of some kind, one of the four major categories is that the moving party has a significant chance of winning eventually.
You have to prove you can win before you can bring the lawsuit, which to me defeats the purpose of bringing a lawsuit. Because if you knew you could win, it's just weird.
It's very strange. No, it's like it ends up creating a trial within a trial.
Right.
And so it's a very strange situation. But the thing is that it has to show that there's at least a likelihood that they'll win on appeal. Or they'll win the case, because that it's not completely frivolous. So for the single judge at the trial level to issue this broad sweeping injunction indicates a very strong belief that they have put on a very strong case.
155 pages. That's a huge opinion.
Right.
I read it.
Well, the same thing happened with DACA and immigration the judge's name. So, I mean, if you're going to take on such a big topic, you really want to make it overwhelming because you know it's going to go up on appeal. So the judge gives this thing, but the appeals court did not explain anything. They just,
yes, real short. It's like three sentences. They just said they stay on the injunction. Right.
Now,
what does that mean?
Even the injunction gave all kinds of exceptions, which are the following are not prohibited by this preliminary injunction from the trial level. Informing social media companies of postings involving criminal activity or criminal conspiracies. And this is what we talked about, you know, last week. It's like, why is it the social media's job to play policeman? And contacting, you know, so if you want to, if there's criminal activity, go arrest them. Don't censor people. Contacting and or notifying social media companies of national security threats, extortion, or other threats posted on its platform. What does that have to do? You know, how would Facebook have a national security threat? I don't get it.
How would they have to have a clearance? You know, they'd have to understand national security. They'd have to become experts in that. Now, and if you remember our bill, Jonathan, we've talked about this too, that I pointed out that that social media has no role in anything except providing the service, just like the phone company. Phone company doesn't arrest you if you make a threat against a public official. You know, the Secret Service does, you know, or the U.S. Marshals. They do it. And the same thing with social media. If you post child porn on social media, you know, social media doesn't have to come after you because the Justice Department will, or the state police or the local police, because that's illegal. Anything that's obscene, well, we have laws against obscenity. Though that's a law enforcement thing. So anything that social media could do to touch anybody's content is already covered by law enforcement. Pornography, obscenity,
right.
Violence, threats, you know, threats against public, all that kind of stuff against public officials, all that's already covered. So there's no reason
right.
for social media to touch anything. That's on social media, however horrendous it might be.
Come.
Yeah.
Right. So they have the Facebook police come arrest you or something.
Facebook can notify the police. I don't care about that. But they can't actually remove the content. They can't do anything.
Right. And the thing is like the things I just mentioned, you know, for the FBI to say, hey, you know, this post is illegal or something.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because remember, when people are indicted, almost always the indictment is under seal. until they're actually arrested.
Hmm.
So, you know, a lot of these people, you know, the idea that if they're, you know, if they know that the indictment is coming, that they might flee or destroy evidence or coordinate their stories with other witnesses.
Hmm.
So, you know, so the thing is, if the FBI were looking at a national security threat, why the hell would they talk to social media about it? They'd go to a grand jury. They could even do something called information without a grand jury. They'd charge the person, and they'd get a court order to take down the information. But they wouldn't alert the offender ahead of time.
Right.
You know, so...
Well,
so anyway,
let me give you
so the whole nonsense.
Well, let me give you a dilemma. Child porn. Nobody wants child porn on social media. It's disgusting. It's horrible. It's illegal. It's all the expletives you could think of. On the other hand, I don't want social media deciding what they're going to remove. So how do we walk this line where we don't want this stuff up? I mean, people can now, of course, people can block it. People don't have to look at this. In fact, I would hope they would. But just the fact that it's out there until law enforcement arrests the people, brings it down, is there anything that social media can do that doesn't give them the role of a police officer? Could they say hide and preserve something as evidence, you know, pending a trial? And if we give them ability to hide things, does that then mean they can go what they do now, which is hide anything they don't like? So how do we balance this? Where's the problem with all laws
is like, and they'll say, you know, child porn, whatever, and or anything else.
Well, it's or anything else that I'm worried about. But the child porn specifically is something that should be dealt with immediately by law enforcement. You don't want it on social media. On the other hand, I don't want social media thinking that they can remove anything just because they have the power to remove anything. It's not their job, not law enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the dilemma.
Plus, I don't believe that it would take that long. Or, you know, if Facebook became aware of child porn, and I have removed some not child porn, but on groups that I manage,
right.
You know, people keep trying from overseas. They keep trying to put up these links to porn. But, you know, I just don't believe that it would take that long for anything like that to be dealt with.
Yeah, it might be seconds.
No,
it might be minutes. Yeah, that's true. That's a good point.
Yeah, I think if they called up the police and they say, hey, we got this. Because, again, traditionally the idea is, like, if someone is spreading child porn, you want to catch them.
Yeah.
You know, if they take down the post and that's bad, you're alerting them. You're not catching them in the act.
Yeah. But the other thing is,
and
these people are smart enough
not
to do
position.
That. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jonathan.
I'm not saying that that's my recommendation. I'm saying that's the traditional approach to law enforcement is that,
right.
You know, we want to catch them, you know, red-handed 10 times over.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, go ahead.
Well, as I said, the child porn people, as much as they are disgusting, are devious enough that they don't want to get caught. So they're not going to blatantly post something on social media because that's going to get flagged. Their IP address is going to get known. The FBI is going to be on their doorstep within, you know, a very short period of time. So they're not going to do that. So the fact that law enforcement polices this is another reason that social media doesn't have to. These people, as horrible as they are, they're not stupid enough to post something that's going to get them caught.
Well,
and that is
a
protection. Yeah, I'm just thinking. I know.
Where
do
the
law
might be
right?
I just don't
originally.
Know.
Okay, Pianchi?
Jonathan, where do the laws against porn originate? Federal, state, or local?
State.
Good question.
For police to be able to get involved, it has to be a violation of a local ordinance or state ordinance. That's the state highway patrol.
Well, I mean, I think it has spread to federal legislation, but it started with state.
Even though we know there's only three federal crimes.
I mean, traditionally, of course, you know, these laws arose before there was an internet. So it would be like, you know, some guy, you know, selling a magazine out of his, you know, out of his trunk or something. I don't know.
So,
prostitution is legal in Nevada.
Yeah.
Prostitution is legal in Nevada. under control of circumstances. That's another good point too.
Yeah, that'd be a whole other show. Hey, I don't want to get too far away from Jonathan's report. What's going on with Stuart Rhodes? What's happened to our buddy?
Well, of course, he's desperately trying to change attorneys. Like, ever since I've known him, he's been trying to find a different attorney.
Wasn't Roger Rhodes defending him, our bud?
No, because he's, you know, they represented anyway, I mean, there's this conflict of interest among these groups. Huh. And so the thing is he was represented by three attorneys. We got one attorney, Ed Tarpley, who, you know, these guys all talk tough. Mm-hmm. And then they're like just complete wimps when it comes time to file something or, you know,
Before. Like the entire Republican Party. That's why we call them the gelding party. There's a reason for that.
Well, so somehow there's a great similarity between Republican lawyers and, you know, they talk.
And gelding.
Talk tough. And then, I mean, the thing is there were a lot of motions that I wrote for his attorneys that were never filed.
How come you weren't his attorney? Could you have done that, maybe I shouldn't ask that on the air.
Well, first of all, no, I had represented Kelly Meigs in the same trial, so I couldn't serve as his attorney.
Okay.
And at the time, then I got they came after me, so I couldn't file those. But there are things I know they didn't do that he had, and he had some brilliant. Suggestions that his attorneys just totally wimped out. They want to be the judge's friend instead of. Yeah.
Would he be better representing himself, Stuart Rhodes? Because he's smart enough to do it. He's got a law degree from Yale.
Except that when you're locked up, 22 hours a day, it's pretty hard to write anything, have access to anything, to get anything done.
Have him call the show. We'll be his internet. Have him call us. I'm serious.
Well. Since he's been actually convicted, he's been they've been much more repressive. So they cut him off from one interview, and because he's before someone is convicted, they have they theoretically have full constitutional rights, even though they abridged them anyway. But now it's gotten worse since he's now he's been moved up to Cumberland, Maryland, and he's sitting there. But they finally. Filed their appeals, which were likely to be lame, and the government saying that 18 years in jail is not enough.
Mm-hmm.
So the government is appealing to put them in jail longer.
All right,
which is probably what?
Well, I was going to say, let's say Trump rides in on the big white horse and pardons all these folks. Are they stuck with if you pardon somebody, are they stuck? I don't like pardoning people that didn't do anything, but I don't want them sitting in jail either. So how do we resolve this? If Trump pardons Stuart Rhodes, for example, and said, is there a way to pardon somebody or just dismiss the charges? Or could Trump's Justice Department just throw out the charges? Say, this was a bogus prosecution. We're ending it, canceling it.
They could do any of those. I mean, remember, we have these actual innocence things. Where someone is convicted of rape and then the DNA analysis has advanced and they find out there's actual evidence that they didn't do it.
Huh.
And the court and the prosecutors can go in, and they really should go in and say, we got this wrong. So they could do that. They could also, because for example, some of these crimes, there are not crimes. They're misusing statutes in a way, and we'll get into that. Actually, this is a good kind of foreshadowing. We'll get into this. Is that they're using statutes in ways that they've never been used before. So it would not be impossible for the prosecutors, for honest prosecutors, to say, is this statute not that statute? For example, the biggest one is the 20-year felony. And that means up to. It doesn't mean, a flat fee sort of thing. But the obstruction of an official proceeding, that has never been used that way before.
Is that a defense? Can they say that in his defense? Say, wait a minute, the law was never intended to be used this way. You know, this is that legitimate?
It is being appealed.
Okay.
It is going to see. The problem is that all of these cases, the action is now going to move more and more to the appeals level.
Okay.
That's very expensive and very slow, and they're trying to raise money. Stewart is trying to raise $200,000 for an appeal attorney.
See, this is wrong too. Why do these people have to raise all this money? Can't we? Would it be worth us passing some kind of a bill or something here, or starting some kind of an action that people who are being accused of these things, because the government has unlimited resources, they can take our tax dollars to prosecute our fellow citizens, and they can still be wrong. And these people can lose simply because they can't raise the $200,000 to defend themselves. There's got to be like a loose haze, or in fact, I was going to write a bill that any government investigation, like an IRS investigation, the government has to pay all the compliance costs. Why shouldn't the government pay all the legal costs up front so these people can defend themselves properly, so they don't lose simply because they don't have the money? And then if they lose the case and they're convicted, then they can pay the $200,000 or whatever the legal fee is.
Mm-hmm.
Well, why can't we do that?
I think there's something needed there. Now, a lot of these people don't trust the public defenders or government paid attorney. You know,
I wouldn't.
Who get their check on the, from the government.
Yeah. But how about like a compliance cost? How about a legal cost up front? So in other words, whatever it costs Stuart Rhodes to defend himself, he would be fronted that. He could put on a good defense, good proper defense, so he doesn't lose simply because he doesn't have the money. What do you think?
But the thing is most of the public defenders that they can get are overworked, and
No, but he could hire his own attorney. He could, if he had $200,000 up front as a legal fee to defend himself in court, he could hire his own attorney. He wouldn't have to be depending on the public defender. So that's what I'm saying. Is in other words, the government pays the cost up front. If the government has taxpayer money to prosecute, investigate, and to do things that they do, why shouldn't the government use taxpayer money to give to the people that they're investigating in the same way?
Well, they probably should. And the thing is, like, for example, we I'm working for the John Pierce Law Firm and Roger Roots. I mean, not like we're sort of a virtual group, so it's not like necessarily formal, but I'm doing a lot of work with them and for them. And
That's interesting. Roger's a friend of the show.
They
I'm familiar with Roger. Yeah,
most
I don't
of them
the
have. Most of these and some of the people. Unfortunately, there are a lot of like attacks back and forth, which is good for no one. That people are getting rich. So I'm like, how do you get rich from people who don't have any money? Even $200,000 is a hell of a lot of money, but appeals are hard. They're very detailed. You have to cite to the transcript. The appeals courts will look for any trap door to toss out the appeal. They've got all these trap doors saying like, oh, you didn't preserve this properly. Or, you filed an objection, but you didn't.
That kind of
so,
stuff.
So, I mean, basically, to preserve the appeal, you have to confront the trial judge that he's making a mistake. So you're in a position of either angering the trial judge or losing your appeal. And everybody knows this. And any trial judge who's not like a child, knows that an attorney must tell him, you're making a mistake. This is wrong. Don't do this. And, but the trial judges are like little petty tyrants and they get offended. And so people are stuck. And then the appeal court comes back and say, oh, you didn't press for a decision. You didn't press forcefully enough. So your issue is lost on appeal. So there's a lot of very tricky appeals are not – I mean, the appeal court is not just going to take the case and, like, review it all from scratch. You have to point out and you say, here, on this page right here, this was an error. And so it's very detailed work. It's very tricky work. You're not just going to have a second look at these things. But, for two things, for example. So, like, we're probably spending on – average about maybe 15,000 per January 6th. Now, some of them are going to be more, some is less. But, you know, where people think that people are getting rich off this stuff, first of all, when you do a criminal defense like this, off the top, you have to deal with expenses. You may have to have a process server to go out and serve a witness subpoena. You may have to print up briefs. You have filing fees. There are things that before the attorney even sees a penny have to be covered. And then, you know, most of these attorneys would be making more money at Home Depot than they would defending January 6th people.
Right.
So, you know, $200,000, you know, sounds like, you know, even that is a lot of money, but that is like, this is like the one of the two biggest trials in the entire ball game.
Well, how much has the government spent prosecuting? I'm just out of curiosity.
I forget the number, but I've seen it, and they keep getting supplements. It's probably approaching $100 million.
So,
including.
Go ahead.
All of the manpower of the FBI and everything like that.
Okay, so if we equalized in the defense fund the amount of money that the government is spending to prosecute anybody, that should cover it. If they can spend $100 million prosecuting him, he should have $100 million for his defense. We'll call it defense.
Yeah, if it were equal, 95% of the people would be found not guilty.
Okay. Well, maybe that's what we should.
I mean, there are some people. I mean, we remember on the video
called
there
defense
were some
equity.
People who were banging.
Yeah.
Huh?
Called defense equity.
I mean, there were some people who were banging on the door of the chambers and sticking their face through, like The Shining, Jack Nicholson in The Shining, you know, sticking his like. You know, there are some who. Yeah. You know, belong in jail for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like what you said about Trump and pardoning. Trump would have to set up a bureaucracy of people who are not corrupt and untrustworthy to go through all of these. And to, you know, he can't just pardon everybody because there are some people who shouldn't be pardoned.
Right.
90 to 95% of them should be pardoned. Now, a pardon, to finish your question a while ago, is to vacate it like it never happened. Now, if people have served time in jail, you can't, you know, undo that. But legally, it's like the conviction and the case never occurred. It's
right.
Erased from history. He can also commute the sentence, which is like saying, okay, look, you did it, but, you know, 18 years in jail is absurd. I'm going to commute it down to 6 months. So the person is still guilty, but the sentence, the president can, you know, can reduce the sentence.
Yeah, but it's not the guilty conviction. Hoping is they'll, like you said, erase it, like it never happened. Mm-hmm. Like the prosecution was bogus, that the charges,
right.
You know, they've been exonerated,
that means,
the term, right?
That means that some group of people are going to have to pour through the records of at least 1,000 cases, and they're still going. And so...
No, take it from Ukraine. Take it to the budget from there. Shouldn't be a problem. You know, stop funding that.
Right, but more than that, it's like... If he goes, because there is an office of pardon attorney, and right now I would assume that they are, I do not know anybody there, but just the way we've seen everywhere else, I would assume that they are utterly corrupt politically.
Yeah.
When you say corrupt, people think that means a bag of money changing hands. Every ordinary person knows that it means twisted in terms of purpose and honesty and integrity. It does not mean that anybody is getting, you know, a bag of money. It means that
it's bribery. It's different.
That would be bribery. But when you say the word corrupt, the judges and everybody else will scream, you're accusing them of bribery. No, I'm not. I'm saying that they are not. It's like Chris Plant says on the radio here in D.C. It's like they're not on our side. You know, every day he likes to summarize all the news items, and he winds them up by saying, because they're not on our side. Or, you know, and he says, this crazy thing happened, and he winds it up by saying, because Democrats. It's the fact that these people are twisted in terms of their morality and their integrity and the purpose that they're trying to achieve.
Well, they don't have integrity. So the option of corruption would be integrity. Okay.
Yeah, gotcha. I mean, I think it's like if you have a machine part that's twisted, so it doesn't work. To me, that's what corrupted means. But I just want people to know that when you talk about corruption, people may scream at you and think you're accusing them of a crime. Like, no, I'm not accusing them of a crime. I'm accusing them of not doing their job. Okay. So I would think that the Office of Attorney, I don't know any of them. I don't know anything about any of them. I would just, on general principle from what we've been seeing, I would fire them all. If Trump came in, he should fire them all. He'd have to hire people he actually trusts.
Well, he's going to have to fire most of the federal government because they're all Democrat, insurgent, Marxist plants. You know, I mean, Schedule F is not big enough. 50,000? No, my thing is I would fire everybody over 30 just as a start.
I don't understand the Schedule F thing, but remember, I worked for 5 years in the U.S. Department of Education, and I was pursuing both political appointments and civil service appointments. I happened to get hired as a civil service, and so I rubbed shoulders with these people, and they kind of figured out I was conservative, but they didn't know how conservative I was. So I can tell you, they are lost boys.
And people hire so they hire their, you know, that's how I get fired so many times because I wasn't of the political or ideological or even the conceptual business view of the person that hired me, you know. But,
they are lost boys.
Yeah. I'm sorry, go ahead.
So that's what would happen if Trump came in. He would have to have somebody. Now, the other thing he could do, what I would say is that, for example, you talk about 18 U.S.C. 1512 where obstructing an official proceeding, where there's no evidence of it whatsoever. Kavanaugh, when they tried to stop Kavanaugh from becoming a U.S. Supreme Court justice, they openly admitted that they were taking over the Senate Hart building. They were taking over the Senate Judiciary Committee to prevent an official government function. They admitted and they got off with a $50 fine.
Mm.
So one thing to do would be for the President Trump to order, okay, everything that the January 6th people are accused of, just give them the same thing that the left got. So if they were convicted of this, I'm commuting it to a $50 fine.
That actually makes sense.
That would be, otherwise it would be a gigantic job to go through all these things. So anyway, that's about Trump and pardoning, and of course, Trump needs to start by firing his own attorneys, as I keep saying. Otherwise,
even Christina Bob, who's been on the show. I mean,
not Christina Bob. Alina Habib is excellent.
Okay.
Dylan Harmit, even though I don't, you know, she's controversial in her role as in the GOP, but she's excellent. Who's the other one? I mean, Jenna Ellis has like gone to all DeSantis, so I don't know, but she was good. And there's a couple others who were excellent.
Yeah, I liked her too. She was great with Giuliani when they did the hearings, the ones that nobody watched.
Right.
proving the election was a fraud. Well, let me just do Schedule F for a second because it's really interesting. It takes 50,000 civil service employees at the upper management and the policymaking level and makes them like cabinet people, makes them subject to hiring and firing the old-fashioned way. So it just converts this, so they lose their civil service and they become simply employees and they can be hired and fired, whatever. Well, 50,000, I wouldn't stop there. I'd go, what's the federal government, over 1 million people? I would take all of them and make them Schedule F. I don't think there should be civil service. I would abolish civil service. You know, another thing that could be done too? Here's another one. We haven't really talked about this. John F. Kennedy is the one who signed an executive order creating federal employee unions. Well, Trump could, in the same way, revoke that, and there wouldn't be federal employee unions, and they'd be gone.
The thing is, there are periods of time in which you couldn't do that politically. Today, it's like, you know, the American people are like all these gelding party people, and you talk about them, like, you don't get it. People hate you. You know, they want to attack Trump so that people, you know, so that their ex-girlfriend will come back and love them and say, we talked about this before. They'll say, you know, so if the old boyfriend points out all right. the faults uh-huh. of the girl's new boyfriend, that uh-huh. will make the girl go, oh, you know what? You're right. I should come back and, you know, and make up with you. Like, you know, it's not going to, I mean, even if the girlfriend says, you know what? You're right. My new boyfriend is a bum. She's never going back to the guy who criticized her decisions. It's not going to happen. You know, it's not the 1950s anymore. The American people are never going, you know, the establishment, the geldings, the, what do you call them? The swamp creatures of both parties. We hate you. We're never mm-hmm. going to stop hating you. We're never going to love you again. I don't mm-hmm. care what you say about Trump.
Yep.
We're not coming back.
Yeah.
You know, it's over. You know, go sell insurance. And so, you know, but they think that, and nothing against insurance. I'm just saying, do something productive with your lives. You know, go do something that, you know, that has nothing to do with Republican politics because you're toast.
Yeah.
So they, you know,
well,
they, anyway, I don't know what you
mean. Yeah. Well, let me ask you a question from an earlier part of the show. What do you think of Vivek Ramaswamy?
I mean, he sounds great. I mean, I'm a little – okay, there's a lot to – I mean, when a politician is willing to say things that are strong and identify with the American voters against the establishment, they're brave. You know, this is why sometimes people say, oh, you want someone who agrees with you 100%. No, no, I'd be happy with someone who agrees with me 80%. But if they're willing to say really strong things, I know they're not going to back down in, you know, when they get in office. Because if they're willing to call the establishment on the carpet, mm-hmm. you know, they're not going to go squishy if they're elected. And mm-hmm. so I don't know if Vivek, you know, just has great speech writers. You know, I don't know if he has great, you know, consultants to write things for his website. But he sure sounds damn good. And most
Does he sound
people,
too good?
Well, I don't know. The way our country is, I don't think there's anything such thing as too good,
okay.
because we are so deteriorated. But the thing is that, you know, the question then becomes, does he mean it? You know, when Ronald Reagan wanted to fight for something, you knew he wasn't just saying it. You knew he
mm-hmm.
meant it.
Mm-hmm.
When Trump says it now Trump, you know, Trump started out kind of wobbly. You know, coming out of the Democratic Party, but you know now that if he tells you he's going to fight for something, he will fight for it. That's the same thing with Christine O'Donnell, who, you know, I helped and as a conservative, and people would say like, oh, you want someone who's 100%, you know, who agrees with 100%. It's like, no, I want someone that if they say they're going to do something, they're going to do it. And you know, I didn't agree with her on everything, like say, well, I don't want to say it, but there are some issues I didn't agree with her on, but I knew that if she said she was going to fight for something, she's going to fight for it.
Right.
And so Vivek,
well,
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, go ahead. Finish your thought. I'm sorry.
Every time I hear him, I'm more and more impressed.
Okay.
And to some extent, RFK Jr. too.
Well,
but
that's I want to talk about
Trump,
him. Yeah, I want to talk about him. In
yeah,
a minute.
But the thing
but,
is,
yeah.
I don't. I'm not saying that Trump is. You know, Trump is not. You know, the he's not the leader of the Christian evangelical movement. He's
mm-hmm.
not. He, you know, he's not the perfect conservative. But if there's a wall, he's going to knock it down.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, or I think
build
that's
it up.
That's what. Well, that kind of okay. There you go. That's true, but if there's a swamp, if there's something in the establishment, he's going to take a wrecking ball to it. And see, this is why the establishment hates him, is because they say, oh, there's too much drama. It's like, how are you going to win a war without drama? You know, they're like, oh, he's a wrecking ball. Yeah, now you're getting it. You know, like Sean Connery says, now you're getting it, old boy. And I keep thinking of that accent.
Sean Connery.
Yeah.
And now what you're now prepared to do. Sorry.
Exactly. So,
money penny.
So everything that the establishment thinks disqualifies Trump is why we want him. We want him to destroy you, establishment. So, you know, I don't know that you know, everything Trump says is perfect on every issue, but I just know that he is going to, you know, to destroy what needs to be destroyed.
Well, let me tell you what I found. Let me tell you what I found earlier this morning. Here's a headline from the Huffington Post, May 3rd, article by David Moy, M-O-Y-E. Vivek Ramaswamy paid to get Soros connection erased from Wikipedia page. Apparently, he got a Soros award, and he wanted that taken out 2 weeks before he declared for president. Let me find the exact line here. It says Mediaite is reporting that Swamy's page now includes a warning that the article has multiple issues, contains paid contributions, and may require cleanup to comply with Wikipedia's content policies. So it says here, Wikipedia's article version history shows that in February, an editor identified by Mediaite as Jay Hofferman removed lines from Ramaswamy receiving a Paul and Daisy Soros Fellowship for New Americans in 2011. How about that?
I didn't know you could do that. I don't know how you can pay to get, but whatever.
Well,
I mean,
no,
yeah,
isn't this interesting? Now, the Huffington Post, okay, the Huffington Post is a liberal paper. They don't like Republicans. So they're actually helping us, pointing out something that the conservatives are not pointing out, that apparently Swamy, you know, who I call Obama, you know, too, because he's the appropriately colored, you know, young, you know, articulate person that brings hope and change. You know, I'm waiting for the three panels. You know.
Somebody said, other people have said that the left will tell you who they're afraid of.
Yeah, but why would they say that this guy has a Paul and Daisy Soros Fellowship, which is so easily verified? We could just look it up. Did he win it in 2011? Why would that be taken off his information if it's so easily verified? Something's wrong here. I think there's something wrong with this guy. Seriously wrong. He's not who he pretends to be.
Could be.
Yeah. There's another one here, too. It says Ramaswamy's page was also edited to remove his role on the state of Ohio's COVID-19 response team. So, in other words, he's a vaxxer. He's a big pharma guy, and he owns a biotech company. Gee, what a surprise. This is when the editor noted that Ramaswamy's request to have his COVID...
I don't know.
I don't either.
All I know
I
is
just found the article.
Great.
Okay. Sounds too great. So let's talk about Robert Francis Kennedy. My contention is, and I said this in a show about a month or two ago, that the reason that the best part about this election is that the Republican Party hates Donald Trump and the Democrat Party hates Robert Francis Kennedy, and it's only a matter of time before those two get together as the non-deep state ticket. Or RFK becomes head of health and human services under Trump.
There is a giant assumption in that people will do what they should do. And I have many broken hearts over people doing what would make sense, what would be a good idea, what they ought to do.
Uh-huh.
But, Ron DeSantis should have waited it out. And
let's talk about him. Why would it was so obvious to us? We said this for months. He's not going to run. He's not that stupid. He can't. If he runs in 2024, he'll also lose 2028. All he has to do is sit up there fat and happy in the governorship of Florida, which he's doing really well at now that he's stopped being a dictator and a COVID freak. But he's actually doing well. You know, Disney thing, yeah, I don't know, maybe yes, maybe no. But he could have just supported Trump, said, yes, I'll be your Trump coordinator, you know, and then ran in 2028 and very likely win. Now he's not going to get that. Now he's not going to get anything. Everybody hates him. He's a donor class. He's now deep state. What an idiot.
Well,
I mean, he's stupid.
I don't think, you know, I really don't think that he is the rhino people think he is. But he has allowed himself to be used by everybody. I mean, he became the great white hope, as the old saying goes, which is actually quite racist, really, but that's the old saying, of all the never Trumpers.
Mm-hmm.
And he, for a long time, he just stayed quiet. And I think with good reason, because, you know, Trump has been indicted. Mm-hmm. He might be,
bogusly
and made unavailable.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like we said before, DeSantis could have ridden in on a white horse and be the savior, and he should have done that. And like I say, I've always thought that we need another 4 years of Trump destroying things, and then we need someone to rebuild.
Mm-hmm.
And DeSantis would have been the perfect person to come back and build, you know, rebuild on the ruins of the corrupt D.C. establishment. Again, I remind people to go back and watch the Capra. Oh, what's the guy's name?
Frank. Frank Capra.
The movie maker, not the other guy.
Frank Capra was the movie maker. Jimmy Stewart. You know, Mr. Smith goes to Washington.
Mr. Smith goes to Washington.
Right.
Because one of the things that I would ask people to go and look at, first of all, they should, you know, probably watch it once a year, but go back and notice how in the 1930s, the Hollywood portrayed extreme corruption in Washington.
Yep.
And the audiences, they were like, yeah, I believe that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in the 30s, it was like, you know, Washington.
Well, Will Rogers.
Yeah.
Remember when Will Rogers said we've got the best Congress money can buy? I mean, he made a living making fun of Congress and corruption.
Right.
Tippi Canoe and Tyler, too. When was that? The 20s?
Yeah, I don't know. So I mean, but you know, the idea that Washington D.C. is corrupt and mostly worthless, you
mm-hmm.
know, is that's almost a century ago, if not more.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, but the thing is,
wait a minute, no, this is really important. There's something really important about that film that you've neglected to mention. You know what has changed since Mr. Smith goes to Washington? The press. Do you remember the journalists, the reporters?
Yeah.
In Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, they were real reporters. They walked a beat. They had sources. They actually wrote stories. They said, we represent the people. You know, they said, you can't trust you people. You represent the government. We represent the people.
Mm-hmm.
And they were absolutely right in those days.
Yeah.
But the press has changed. Do you remember Dustin Hoffman and Robert Redford in All the President's Men? Talking about the Washington Post. Jason Robards played, actually looked like Ben Bradley. That was kind of funny, actually. They really looked alike. Ben Bradley was the editor of the Washington Post back when it was an actual newspaper. And they actually typed things up on, you know, carbon paper and things like that. But what really has changed since Mr. Smith, the politicians are just as corrupt as they've always been, if not more so, because now they have the internet and they can fundraise better. But I think what's changed is the press. There is no press. There is no Fourth Estate or whatever they're called. There is no journalist class that wants a story. They don't want to be a.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to write a story against government. They want to be the government.
Right. They want a pat on the head with them.
Yeah.
They Chris Plant is our local DC thing, and he whenever he references the Washington Post, he says it's almost like a newspaper. But it's not. That's how he describes the Washington Post. It looks like a newspaper, but it's not.
Hmm.
So
he should have us as
guests.
Do you know Chris Plant? I mean,
he's great.
Okay, well, let's get on his show.
So anyway,
I'm serious.
So we've gone through all this and haven't even. I guess we're coming near the end of the. The hour.
Yeah, we got Dorothy coming up next. Yeah.
So, but I mean, things are up. I have not gone into the nitty gritty. Let me just preview it, I guess, for the January 6th cases, because there's a lot of minutia and a lot of cases. And, you know, I didn't think it was necessarily of broad interest to go into the nitty gritty issues of, you know, of each case and the latest details and things like that. But
right.
We're really starting to see some themes emerge that are extremely disturbing. And, you know, they're basically rewriting our country in the criminal prosecutions of January 6th. How much time do I have here?
We got about 2 minutes right now, but let's. I've already written down next week January 16th because this is something that's critical. They're prosecuting them. And I have an article coming out on Substack right after the show. I've almost proofed it and rewritten what I want, saying the government is always right, and that's how they can judge what is misinformation because they can't be wrong, you know. And so we're going to talk about that.
But you look at
January 6th, and they're basically prosecuting people for thinking for themselves, for objecting to what the deep state is doing. For actually telling the first people have been prosecuted for truth. Well, not the first. I mean, Galileo was. But this is a longstanding tradition of governments to crucify metaphorically or physically anybody who stands in the way of their power. And all the January 6th people did was say, I want the battleground states with Trump electors and Brennan electors to have them go back to the states and let them pick the right one. That's it. That was what January 6th was all about.
They'll claim that they'll not, you know, when we found most, first of all, people should understand that everything that they can think about January 6th, attorneys are filing motions and fighting these arguments. It's just that the judges aren't, you know, the judges that would listen to arguments in any normal case are just not buying it in these cases. It's a total different, law applies here, which is basically none at all. But when we keep filing lawsuits saying that politics should not be allowed, you know, people should not be prosecuted for the politics, they're saying, oh, we're not doing that. And then they spend the entire trial doing it. So the idea that they're prosecuting people for unapproved opinions, it really is true.
Yeah.
You know, and it costs a lot of money to get the transcripts, but we have the transcript, you know, we can prove it from the transcripts. I mean, because they do want to say, like, well, we want to show their intent, what was their mindset, and, you know, there's some of that's true, but they go way beyond that to just telling a D.C. jury, 91% of whom voted for Biden, that, you know, these people don't believe what you believe. We just had a trial end up, and I know you're out of time, where a pastor.
Well,
Dorothy's
going to be a couple
son,
minutes. We got a couple more minutes. Dorothy's got something to just take care of first, then she'll be right with us. So, yeah.
Well,
keep
I'll
going.
Just say this and consider it a preview, a trailer. They were just convicted of the four misdemeanors when there was absolutely no evidence of at least three of them. I mean, we thought this was going to be the first one where a jury found them not guilty because there was no evidence at all of any kind. All the
no plea deals, right? These weren't plea deals. They didn't accept the misdemeanor plea deal, so they didn't get a bogus felony charge. They would take a bogus misdemeanor charge. So they actually went to trial.
They were only prosecuted for the standard four misdemeanors, which is going in the restricted area, which maybe they could have made that stick. Then being disorderly and disruptive in a restricted building, being disorderly and disruptive in a Capitol building, and parading, demonstrating, or picketing in a Capitol building. You know, there's several buildings on the Capitol complex. And there was just no evidence whatsoever. We asked the captain of the U.S. Capitol Police, like, you know, did they parade? No. Did they demonstrate? No. Did they kick anybody? No. Did they, you know, brawl with anybody? No. Did they, you know, were they disruptive? It said, well, and this is where the raindrop theory, if I have, at some point,
actually,
I have time
you don't.
To read
Dorothy's here now, so we're going to go, we're going to move
all
on.
All right, well,
to
we'll,
her in
we'll
just
do
a second here.
So you can look forward to that next week.
Yeah, should be fun. Well, I mean, and these principles are so critical. So thank you, sir, and keep working on it.
All right,
and
okay.
You take care. All right.
All right, you too.
Wait a minute. I was in the wrong place. I had Dorothy's old commercial, which I'm going to play at some point and surprise her once again. Where did I? Here's what I want. Sex. Everybody talks about it. Some of you are even doing it. But are you really talking to the person you are doing it with? It all comes down to communication. That's where Dorothy Diana comes in. Dorothy is a sexual health nurse educator. She has studied hypnotherapy, Reiki, and many other disciplines. And what is sex without sensuality? Something has to light your afterburner. Join us now for a sometimes very frank and occasionally quite descriptive conversation of sex and sensuality with Dorothy Diana. Whew. I mean, just listening to that, I just totally changed my mood and go, okay, now, totally different subject. You know, like the politics goes away. I feel like the waterfall, you know, it's like all my politics goes over the cliff with the waterfall, crashes to the bottom. It's all gone. Now I'm just like this calm lake up top and everything's great. Hi, Dorothy.
Hi. I'm glad you feel that way. That sounds pleasant. I can't imagine if you were saying, oh, Dorothy, now you're here. I get so stressed out when it's time to talk to you.
No. This is the anti-stress hour. This is the relief from all the heavy stuff we deal with. Well, have you ever checked out the show and listened to? You don't even have to listen to the full, but get a feel for like the first hour when I actually had Pianki and I had Josh from Illinois join us, and we had a, you know, really intense discussion, and then Jonathan, we're talking legal stuff, and that was more technical, but still pretty intense. And then your show comes on, and it is the biggest change that we do all week.
Yeah, so I do. You know, I listen. I do Pilates on Monday, and I have a half an hour drive home because I moved. It's a very good class, and so it's worth it. But on the way home, I put on your show to just kind of catch up what y'all are talking about. And meanwhile, I'm usually getting texts from a lot of people. So, but yeah, it's definitely a different vibe.
No, yeah, totally. Well, that's why I like having you on. I don't want to be consistent the same. I don't want to be like Rush Limbaugh, who basically did a one-hour show three times. All you had to do was listen to 1 hour, because the next 2 hours are pretty much the same thing.
Which is
no fun. Yeah, my hours are completely different. So what's going on in sex and sensuality? What's happening in the emotional world out there?
Well, I love the post. The post you tagged me on, and then I reposted it. And it was so beautifully written. It was almost like a poem. And she talked about insecure attachment. So I reached out after I got some comments, and then I got some private messages on that one too, and some really good feedback. And it's cute how no one wants, people don't really want to call in, a lot of people, and discuss it, but they want to just tell me privately all their thoughts.
You can read comments,
and then I talk about it.
Believe that happens all the time to me. I've had constant people, you know, I said, come on the show. Have you ever noticed my book? Come on the show and talk. No, I can't do that. I'm sorry.
It's hard because we'll have to know exactly the right thing to say, or they might sound silly. And I understand that. And
I don't know the right thing to say. And I do sound silly.
Neither.
A lot of times.
Well, okay. So just briefly, just to catch, I would like to just, I'll just read a piece of that out loud and then kick off the discussion, because it's, I think this is very, very prevalent, almost to the point of being epidemic in masculine feminine energy relationships. And it's reflective of some wounding. It's reflective of what we can call the shadow feminine or the shadow masculine. And, you know, the overarching goal for me, and I'll just say this, you know, in case, just to wrap, why are we talking about this? The overarching goal for me is a wonderful, beautiful, committed, sacred, long-term, hopefully for life, monogamous relationship with your intended beloved, where there is polarity, therefore intense passion and chemistry, as well as a deep mutual respect, seeing each other, hearing each other, being able to live your lives, carrying out maybe a mission that benefits the community, benefits your family, and also having your own, you know, a little bit of your own thing aside from each other to recharge. But this beautiful balance, a best friendship, passion, and commitment for life. So this for me is the goal for the kind of people I talk to and I sort of cohort with. This is really the goal, the coming together of the masculine energy, feminine energy in a really beautiful way that brings strength to yourself and others around you.
Yes.
So, yeah. So that's why I felt this post was important, because this is seen a lot, this type of coming together where the wounding isn't quite healed and there's still a lot of inner child fears and reactivity from parenting situation usually that wasn't ideal, and or relationships where there was and I hate this, I don't hate this word, but if this word is overused, I'm just going to say where trauma happened and just wounding of the soul a little bit from relationships that went really badly.
No, I got both of those.
Yeah, we all do.
And the marriage. I actually have all three. Family, relationship, and marriage, you know, trauma. And so,
Real.
But I'm still here. Life goes on, you know.
We all have it. You can't avoid it. I don't believe you can avoid it. I think the only way to avoid it is to never enter relationship. And that is a lonely, sad place. Relationships are where we learn about ourselves. We grow, we heal, and we learn what love really is. And that's kind of why we're here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so
what'd you find
read
as much as you want because it's really interesting. Yeah.
Okay. Insecure, this is The Soul Journey with Sarah Musa. That's the title of the page, but that's not who wrote it. She copied it from this other author that I'll say at the end. Insecure attachment is wounded polarity. If there is attraction, there is polarity always. But what that polarity is and how it plays out really depends on what is driving it. Just like a magnet, attraction is always to an opposite. A feminine being yearns for her masculine, and a masculine being pursues his feminine. Attraction is not rational, however, and sadly, the nature of this day and age has given us more kinks than we know how to handle. The masculine, so stoic, so independent, so freedom-focused, when wounded, he does not know how to truly embody this freedom. Instead, he pushes away, hides his feelings, becomes untouchable. In a man or a woman, usually a man, we call this avoidant. The feminine, so receptive, so intimate, so relationally focused, when wounded, she does not know how to truly relax into intimacy. Instead, she clings, overshares her feelings, becomes needy. In a woman or man, we call this anxious.
Mm-hmm.
These two poles, avoidant and anxious, dance together in a dysfunctional tango of suffering. Push and pull, break up and make up, hot, but not hot. This is a polarity. The wounded masculine fights for his freedom at the expense of a relationship, and the wounded feminine fights for connection at the expense of herself. Together, they tear apart any possibility of the true depths of intimacy available. Because in order to find attraction with our mate, we always need polarity. And if we haven't healed our nervous systems, haven't discovered how to bond as integrated adults, then what you will find is this wounded dance where love withers and the petals of hope fall without renewal. To truly know the possibilities of masculine and feminine polarity is to grow beyond the insecurity. Passion thrives in secure relating. And the author of this is Damien Bowler,
mm-hmm.
who I don't know much about, but apparently a lot of people do. So that's interesting.
I think very interesting. And I actually post something on another post, on I think the original, and I thought I'm dragging it up, but I thought it'd be more important to listen to you and take your take on this, but it comes back to what I've said. Men feel secure when they're free, and women feel free when they're secure. We are polar opposites, but those opposites are necessary for attraction. I agree with that. I mean, polarity, you look at magnets, you know, you flip the polarity, they attract you, you flip back again, and they repel each other. It's quite interesting the way the attraction, and I actually related this to physics when I wrote about this, and I'm thinking, for some reason, planets came to mind, and planets orbit around the sun. So they have a mass and they have a velocity, and that mass and velocity balances gravity pulling us towards the sun and centrifugal force pushing us away from the sun. So you got four forces in balance. We're like, relationships are kind of the same way. We, as people, have mass, we are real, we have velocity, we're moving through life. We have both gravity towards another person and centrifugal force pushing us away. So in the same way that planets hold their position, we can hold our position with people, but recognize there are multiple forces pulling us in all directions and balancing those. This is where relationships take effort, I wouldn't say work necessarily, but they take participation. You got to be participating. Because you've got to maintain, you've got your mass, you got to maintain your velocity together, but you're going to have forces that attract you and pull you apart, and you got to balance those. It's really quite fascinating. Mm-hmm. You can almost quantify relationships in physical terms, but it still comes back to men feel secure when they're free and women feel free when they're secure. That's Greg's axiom for
energy.
Yeah.
Physics is as energy, and a lot to do with energy, and so is the relationship. So it's interesting because you can pinpoint the exact behaviors someone does when it comes, when it comes to, I guess we're talking about anxious avoidant relationships, which is a typical relationship. It's a very typical bond because the anxious person needs more and more and more, and then the avoidant keeps pulling back, right? The avoidant feels very scared and trapped when the anxious member of the relationship keeps asking for more closeness and neediness and reassurance, and they pull back.
Yeah, more gravity creates
Yes, and then it's just this really bad cycle, and then it erupts usually in a big fallout, blowout, and then there's possibly, you know, if the avoidant has indeed now ghosted or completely gone AWOL, the anxious is literally having panic attacks and spinning out.
And anxiousness, the desire for more gravity actually causes more centrifugal force. In other words, the need to be closer and more, shall I say, controlling, actually causes more desire to be further and further away. And
it's
it's
interesting that you said controlling, because if we take this into feminine masculine energy talk, first of all, the fact that it is like physics, so people feel the energy. It's not just your behaviors and what you say and do. Literally, your couplehood, the person you're in couple with can feel the energy of your focus, complete focus and attention on them, anxious people. So they have to heal, and they have to learn, if they're ever going to be happy in a relationship, they have to learn how to fulfill themselves with happiness outside the relationship. Heal the wounding, because it usually comes from abandonment issues as a child. It can come from also being cheated on an adult, but almost everyone, it's childhood. I mean, I don't think there's anyone I've ever talked to that's not from childhood, including myself, because I'm a healing, anxious, attached. But the energy is very, what you touched on about energy and about control. So energy, both members feel the other person's energy without them saying a thing, even if you're not in their presence. The anxious can feel the avoidant moving away and being off, like the relationship going somewhere else entirely with their attention and just escaping. And the avoidant can absolutely feel the energy of the anxious, like, on them. Because if you successfully can get your anxious friend to get distracted for a few hours, even for an overnight, like get out of town, really do something that's fun for her, all of a sudden the avoidant starts to knock on the door again, little text here and there. It's very interesting. And then you talked about control, and that's big too, because the shadow feminine is control. So the feminine energy is receptive.
There was a very positive reason I said that. When I'm talking control, I'm not talking, you know, outright overt manipulation or you know, threats, extortion, all that kind of stuff. What I'm talking about basically is relationship rules and expectations. And so this is and then it is the dark side of feminine. I think this causes a lot of problems for masculine, for men, in that rules and expectations are used, you know, in ways to set the boundaries of the relationship, you know, for what the woman wants, not considering necessarily what the guy wants. The guy wants, well, I want to do this, I want to do that. I'm, you know, it doesn't mean I care for you any less, but, you know, for me, this is kind of important. You know, let's say rock bands. Okay, I like playing rock bands. I know more rock bands that have been destroyed, and not just men. But partners, you know, whether it's a female to a guy or, you know, a guy to a woman, like a woman lead singer, for example, and the guys in the audience, like, don't flirt with the members of the band. Don't do this. You know, you can't have this outlet. And, oh, she's just playing music. Right. I've seen this personally. And so this is a control rules and expectations thing. Whereas if you 38 Special had it right, hold on loosely, but don't let go. You know, it's it really comes down to that people, you know, will be closer to you if you let them be themselves. And it's one of the most attractive things.
I mean, so, but this comes from being healed, Greg. And so we're talking about people who, and this is so prevalent that I think it's worth talking about.
Yeah, please.
You know, how do you get to that place that you're talking about? How do you get there? And if you're anxiously attached because, you know, you had family abandonment issues, you weren't emotionally cared for, you had to completely obsess with your caregiver as a small child because they left or they're emotionally cut off from you, which is very wounding to a child to have, especially the maternal energy cut off, the emotional nurturing cut off, whether she physically
Mine was worse. Babysitters for 3 weeks or longer sometimes that were abusive. So not only was my caregivers, my parents, gone, I had people that in place that were actually a threat. So it's like,
so this,
okay.
And this is, unfortunately, it's more common than, I think if people come from healthy families, they don't understand this, but many people do. And so the goal of
the
anxious attachment style is to then become your own caregiver. So literally emotionally go through a process where you learn to parent yourself. So you're not relying on that outside your relationship.
That is exactly,
and that's a long journey.
Happened. Yep.
But the, you know, find what makes you happy. You know, I recommend people, you know, this as simple as making a list of things that literally bring you a physical feeling of joy. And if you don't have that, if you can't think of anything that actually makes you happy, then I would recommend probably professional help, really.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, happiness is a natural state.
A deadened soul in there. Yeah.
Isn't that really true? I mean, happiness is not happy all the time, not giggly, hysterical happiness, but generally happy is your natural state. And if you're not generally happy most of the time, because everybody has bad days, bad things, you know, we know that. But how do you be with another person if you're not generally happy? Because all you're going to bring is negative energy.
Well, you're going to rely on them an anxious attachment will rely on her partner for her happiness frequently. Like the only joy comes from how they interact with me. And if they say the wrong thing, I'm cascaded into depression and anxiety. And if they say the right thing, I'm floating on cloud nine. It's a lot of extremes, constant need of reassurance, very afraid of rejection, cheating, obsessed with the relationship, like constantly thinking about it, gets very panicky if there's any kind of distance, whether it's emotional or physical, over-pleasing, overworking in a relationship, doing way too much to try to be the perfect person, cooking the perfect meals, having the house always look good, your hair always looks good, everything is perfect. And this is not because you're loving self-care and because you have self-pride and you're taking care of yourself with a healthy, integrated masculine. It's because you need to prove, you know, all of it is an effort to land him. All of it is an effort to gain love from someone else. So,
yeah, we don't think of landing women. It's kind of interesting. Yeah, and one of the strongest ways to control people is to be nice and do things for them. And then say, look what I've done for you.
Martyr,
that's the dark side.
Altruistic place. Yes, you're giving what you don't have to give. You're giving to get instead of just giving because you want to and it fills you up. And that's a very healthy place to come from, in my opinion, when you have that desire to give just because you have it to give and you want to improve someone else's life or help them. It's beautiful. So to heal the anxious attachment is finding self-care, a lot of self-care, putting the attention back on yourself and healing that little child inside that felt neglected. So it's a lot of self-talk, a lot of, I always recommend post-it notes around the house everywhere, just with beautiful things to say to yourself. You're safe, you're beautiful, all will be well. I highly recommend a spiritual practice, daily prayer. I think confessing everything to Father God in a very open way, and I'm in a program right now. I'm always in a program. I love them. But it's so spiritual and uplifting spiritually that it makes me very happy. Because a lot of programs don't talk about God a lot, but I think it's hugely important for healing to have a spiritual connection.
Yeah. Well, and this is something I think is so critical too. One of the things I noticed on the show is slightly off topic, but that the people that believe the most strongly in freedom also believe the most strongly in God, that God is freedom. God is not a restriction. This is it's very common to the show. I picked this up. I've been doing the show over 5 years.
God is freedom. Yeah.
God is freedom. And if you go to religion, God is not freedom. God is restriction. God is pain. God is to be feared. God is fire and brimstone. That's the human version. But if you go to the actual God in scripture, especially when we have our Oh My God report with Wendy, you should listen to Wednesdays with Wendy's because our conversations are incredible too. But we talk a lot about that. She loves scripture, loves God, hates churches, hates priests that are abusive, priests, pastors, ministers, all these folks that are putting God in their view. And God loves freedom. God wants us to be free.
Which is very interesting because the masculine loves freedom. The masculine needs it. And speaking on freedom, the only way to be truly free for the feminine energy that's in her shadow, the only way to be truly free is to truly love yourself, I believe, to really learn to love yourself independently of anyone else. The freedom that comes from being completely independent, You know, I don't believe that we're actually independent as humans. So what I mean by that is not codependent. So interdependent, you have relationships where you help each other and you're supportive, yet you're not dependent on them for your basic survival and basic happiness. So mm-hmm. you have all of that outside the relationship, whatever it is, yet you can rely on others in a healthy way.
Well, it's like you're still your own person in a relationship. You're not, you don't give up your personality. There's not like this third personality. There's you by yourself when you're by yourself or single, you know, the other person when they're single, and together, you know, you're still two people who are individuals, and you create a relationship and a partnership from that. But there isn't this entity of the relationship that then disavows, disqualifies, and eliminates your individual person. I think that's a mistake people make sometimes too.
I don't know how you'd even enter a relationship. Well, I know how you can enter it, but I don't believe it's even sustainable for long term to be in a relationship.
Well, I don't think so either.
With an anxiously attached person, unless they've done most of their healing and they just have little tendencies to that. Because mm-hmm. when you've done most of your healing and you just have tendencies, you can actually almost have a sense of humor about it, and you can accept it. You can say, you know, yeah, I get like that sometimes, right? Like, and your partner knows that. Like, yeah, sometimes I freak out if I start to feel like, you know, you don't see the beauty in me, or, you know, you're really busy at work. Sometimes I get really anxious and I'm learning to deal with that. And I've got these tools I'm using, but just, you know, bear with me. And if you can have that kind of attitude and they're cool with it, I think it works. Mm-hmm. But the severely anxious who hasn't done any work, this is actually more pretty common. And I just don't see how it's sustainable for the long term, because they're completely dependent on every little thing the other person says and does is, you know,
we can't do that.
A whirlwind.
But let's talk about this, because this sounds more of a woman thing than a guy thing. I don't think guys think of themselves as dependent
on women.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that, because it's interesting. Mm-hmm. But guys need to understand this. They need to understand that if there's a woman who is, you know, relationship dependent or somehow, what do you call it, attention dependent? Or what's the word you use? Anxious dependent. No, there was something else.
Well,
anxious attached.
Anxious attached.
That's what it is.
And it's
generally
characterized by severe codependence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. But that's really interesting. So in other words, a guy is not going to be free in a relationship with a person who's anxiously attached, and they may not know why.
No.
They may think the guy might not understand. This is why guys need to understand this, because this would be a great guy workshop. You know, that here's, you know, that women are much, much more defining themselves by their relationships. I made this post too, a comment. Men define themselves by their accomplishments. Women define themselves by their relationships. So women are more dependent on relationships for their identity, for who they are. Guys are more dependent on what we do. So I don't think of, you know, if I had a girlfriend, which I might even try again. I think it's probably a good idea at this point. But if I have a girlfriend, that's not going to be my primary identification for me. It's going to be Action Radio. This is what I do.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I have a girlfriend. Yeah. Isn't this great? You know, and I play rock and roll. Isn't this great? You know, and I go bike ride and, you know, and talk to the animals. Isn't that great too? But my primary identification is Action Radio. This is where I spend most of my time. This is my passion. This is where I put my work into. And I don't think that's a bad thing, but that's much more of a guy orientation.
A healthy masculine is not going to be attracted to anxious attachment, actually. So the interesting conundrum here is, if you're securely attached, you may get involved with anxious attached, but if they're pretty down that path and they haven't done their work, mm-hmm. usually a higher quality masculine is not going to take him long to figure that out, because she can only have that persona.
Yeah, but guys don't have a word for
that. She can only have that persona for so long. It's good. The world's going to start crumbling pretty soon.
Yeah.
And it's not going to work out.
Well, you know, what's interesting too is a woman who doesn't want to show that side will come off as confident, and of course, if they're narcissists, they can just lie through their teeth. But if they're just talking about a woman who like wants to put the best face forward, you know, everybody's great on the first date, and then things kind of go crazy.
Yeah, exactly.
So the mask is on for 3 months, and they're confident, and they're secure, and the relationship is great. But then who they really are.
Yeah, because they don't care that much. Because they don't care that much. Because
they're not attached.
You know, if they're at all functional, so I'm not talking about severe psychiatric or, you know, but if they're at all functional in life, they're probably going to have somewhat of their own life. And and they don't have feelings yet. They don't have those feelings of attachment yet. It's when the feelings come that the shit hits the fan. Excuse my language.
That's okay. We've heard it before. So if that's the situation, so how do women get to a place where they can be attached, happily attached, you know, not anxiously attached, but, you know, hold on loosely, but don't let go attached. Thank you.
You may never heal fully, but there's so much work that can be done to get you to that place. And again, I believe God has someone for everyone. And I believe in abundance and abundance of love. And, but nobody can truly, you can't truly love someone else unless you love yourself, period. It's not really love. It's enmeshment and, you
right.
know, and it, and
What's
so,
mean?
So don't fool yourself, first of all, to think if you haven't done your work, you're going to end up in a great relationship that's really meaningful for both of you. Because if you don't have self-love, you know, you can't really give to others in the way that they deserve. So you have to do the work first. And if you don't, you know, you're going to get triggered to no end until you're so miserable and everyone else is so miserable that you do the work, hopefully.
Yeah. I was talking to someone recently about this. You know, women seem to define themselves more as either in a relationship or between relationships, whereas guys are more likely to say single. You know, in other words, relationship.
Isn't
is,
that interesting?
You know, it's not a constant with guys that we have to be in a relationship. So how do we get women to a place where they are not devaluing a relationship, but have it be a place where they can love themselves? Because I don't think guys suffer from not loving themselves. In fact, probably just the opposite. You know, we get pretty confident, but we have accomplishments to fall back on. You know, if we're not in a relationship, I can say, yeah, I'm not in a relationship. I don't have a girlfriend yet. Might be kind of be interesting because that I think would be a lot of fun and would definitely, you know, enhance my life, but it could also take away from my life. So I want to make sure that it enhances my life and doesn't take away from my life. I'd rather not be with someone than be with someone that takes away from my life. Been there, done that, you know, got the t-shirt. But guys, like I say, with our accomplishments, with the things that make us who we are, that we do, whether we're in a relationship or not, that's almost like a safeguard against, you know, becoming anxiously attached, because we don't have to be attached to feel good about ourselves. But I think there's a certain portion of women that do. That is somehow in your makeup as women, that by defining yourself more with relationship and social relationships and friendships, interconnections, and all the things that the wonderful things that you women do, there's the shadow side to it, like you say. And how guys need to learn about this too. They need to everybody needs to learn about each other's shadow side. But how do we get from anxious attachment to comfortable attachment to, you know, recognizing freedom attachment? And I'm not saying, when I say freedom about guys, I don't mean guys cheating. I don't mean guys having open relationships. I don't mean that at all. I mean that they don't
exactly
have so many.
What you mean.
Yeah, I know, but I want to make sure everybody else does too. But the guy doesn't have to live under so many rules and expectations, especially changing rules and expectations, that they're always off guard. They're never sure of what's going on, that the person is so needy, the woman is so needy, that she needs to put conditions on to make sure that the guy doesn't leave, do things or whatever. You know, I'm thinking of Carrie Underwood, who destroyed her, you know, boyfriend's pickup truck, you know, for cheating. Well, first of all, there's probably a reason that we should analyze that song one day. Because first of all, there's a reason that the guy cheated, maybe right or wrong. But the second thing is, destroying his pickup is not going to endear this guy to Carrie Underwood. Ain't going to happen. He's going to call her a psycho and leave. Okay. So, well, better not cheat again. And so there's a myth. So we should talk about this. This is kind of interesting, actually. So the message for women is, if your guy cheats, you can, you know, destroy his pickup. And it's okay because you're justified. You know, the message for guy is, there's some really psycho women out there that will destroy your property.
Men have every reason to think women are crazy, because we have so many wounded feminine. And like we talked about, the shadow of the feminine is control. And so control can look like a lot of things. So, and it's very, very frightening for that little girl inside to feel that she doesn't have love and she doesn't have control and any bad things can happen to her and no one's going to protect her. And that's very frightening. And so a frightened person doesn't behave well usually. And that fear, anger is just fear, fear with a wall up, right? So destroying someone's truck is obviously a reaction, the behavior that is extreme. And if someone cheated, you are either magnetized. This is probably going to piss people off. I don't care. I mean, I
go
do
for
or
it.
I don't. But
we
if
do
you're
that every
cheated
day.
On,
right.
If you're cheated on, you either didn't notice red flags going into the relationship, or you didn't notice red flags during the relationship, or the person's needs are not being met. There's not good communication about the needs, or there is communication, yet you're not doing what is needed. So there are reasons people cheat. Women usually cheat. You know, we've discussed this, for emotional reasons, being neglected emotionally. And men cheat for a variety of reasons. They like sexual variety. They may have low ethical standards, or they may feel neglected physically. They're not getting their needs met. But if someone, if you're being cheated on, I mean, it is highly evolved way of thinking to first say what, I mean, for everyone's going to be devastated, you know, most people at first, but then how did I contribute to this? How did I not see this coming? How did I magnetize this experience to myself? Right. Hmm. So adjusting your own behavior is one of the first steps in healing, adjusting your own thoughts and your own behavior. It's not trying to make someone else be different. Right. It's figuring out what you did to invite this into your life. How did it get this far with you allowing things to go, right? Not noticing this is real. We magnetize what we believe, and we magnetize based on old wounds.
Well, back to Carrie Underwood, you know, the song assumes that the woman is perfectly right. Well, I love doing this because pop culture is so informative sometimes when you look into it. So Carrie Underwood assumes that she was probably cheated on. I bet you she was cheated on. We don't know the story, but, you know, we can guess. It's like, who is that, the woman that the really popular singer that writes about every bad relationship she ever had? You know the one I'm thinking of.
They all do. They all write. Okay. They all write about how awful love is and how everyone's a jerk and I'm always miserable and he did this. And then this longing, pining, I can never get him. I miss him so bad. I mean, it's honestly ludicrous. It gives such bad messaging, but go ahead.
Well, no, it's funny. Actually, I remember joking around that women write hate songs, guys write love songs. I love you. I want you. Mm. You know, look at all the guys.
Well,
songs, Roxanne, you know,
it's very rarely healthy love songs. It's very rarely healthy. It's usually, right.
Well, we should look at song lyrics sometime. This is kind of fascinating. Anyway, the original point where I started with this was the woman in Carrie Underwood's song assumes that she is absolutely 100% right and the guy is 100% wrong. And if she punishes him, he'll behave correctly from there on. None of that is true.
Of course. It's insanity.
Yeah, but it's kind of interesting. I should write the guy.
I mean, the only thing you can do is walk away and heal yourself. Really. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, you cannot control or change someone else, and you can't make them love you, obviously. And, you know, that's part of the anxious attachment. The goal is to make them love me, make them commit, make them stay.
But you can't do that.
And the more they do, there's an empty hole there, and it's never filled. He can never fill her hole.
I know what you mean.
Anyway.
Even though the humor is there, yeah.
satisfy them. You, nobody is satisfied. Yes, he's always feeling it's never enough, and she's always wants more and that more validation. And so it's a lose-lose. And the avoidant, we should touch on the avoidant because that's the masculine. And again,
I was going to ask you, what's the shadow masculine?
Avoidant.
Yeah, what's the shadow masculine corollary to anxious attached shadow feminine?
Yeah, so the masculine masculine side of this is the avoidant personality, and the avoidant, avoidant doesn't believe that emotional connection is that important, and that's simplifying it, but they don't value that. They more value tasks and that things are sort of arranged in a certain way, and it seems to work on the surface.
So it looks like a relationship without actually being one. That's kind of interesting.
Well, we coexist, but we're doing our own thing, essentially. You know, I don't want you too close. They find the closeness very messy, very threatening. And the anxious wants nothing more than intense closeness, right? So the avoidant is emotionally neglectful, to simplify it. And it's very, even if someone's securely attached, it can be very unsettling and sad to be part of that relationship. You know, a securely attached relationship, that, you know, you're a team and there's emotional connection. The avoidant personality doesn't really see relationships that way. They're very, very independent and they like their life just so. And they don't really want anyone coming in and disrupting it as they see it. They see it as disruptive.
Yes, like anybody, that's a narcissist thing where anybody else is a threat to the relationship, whether it be family, friends, you know, job. The more oppressive a relationship gets, the faster the guy is going to try and get away from it and run away. And weird things will happen, you know, drink with the guys, you know, gambling, cheating, you know, all the things that people do. And you're still not dealing with the problem. You got two people that are coming from an irrational position, you know, the over-controlling woman and the avoiding guy. So, you know, so the woman says, we have to talk. Well, the guys don't like to hear that.
No, nobody wants to hear that.
But if you say, hey, I really like to talk to you about something, That's a totally different attitude.
Well, hey, you know, okay, I have cool. something I on that. My mind. What, when is a good time for you where we can have?
I
wouldn't
even make it that formal.
For you.
It's like, hey, I got a question. Well, okay, fine. What's your question?
I don't know.
Why do we have to
when
say
I'm
we have to talk? Mm-hmm. You know, but you see how controlling that is? We have to talk. In other words, you have to talk to me is what that woman's saying. Because usually women say,
well,
it's
very masculine. It's a masculine approach, not to confuse issues. But if you're trying to keep the polarity, we have to talk is a controlling masculine way to present it. Whereas, hey, honey, I know you've been so busy. Mm-hmm. You know, I appreciate all you do. There has been something on my mind. So if you have... If you have a time that would work for you for us to sit down together, that would really mean a lot to me.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd probably say,
how does that, you know,
let's go to brunch. let's do something fun. You know, I don't, can you talk about things while doing something fun, or is that distracting, I wonder? Huh.
It just depends. If it's going to be a deep conversation and you're in public, you know, if you feel like a little inhibited from having others around or distractions, you know, I'm not sure, really. But so the avoidance, the anxious will sometimes attempt closeness by, and I don't want to say this, it's not conscious, but subconsciously creating drama if they're in with an avoidant and nothing seems to, quote, work. So then they'll create some negativity and drama just to get a reaction, just to get some closeness. And what happens,
Make up sex.
If there's anything, well, I wish, that would be lovely, wouldn't it? What happens with the avoidant? If there's any negative emotions in their partner, they take it very personally. They retreat more. They distance more. They will, like, climb over the furniture metaphorically to try to get away from dealing with any negative.
Well, I don't think it's so metaphorical,
know, like
sometimes.
Jumping off the balcony.
I'm sure people have actually, you know, what's that Paul Simon song, The 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover?
Yeah.
You know, they're all guy characters, you know, just drop off the key, Lee, and get yourself free. How about the back, Jack? There's no women in that song leaving their lovers. It's just all guys. I just found that interesting. Little things I think about.
Well, for sure. Okay. Because it's real. Right. Because she got crazy and depended too much on him, and she's bringing drama, and he's done. So he will absolutely detach in any way possible, avoiding any deep conversation, isolating. Mm-hmm. If you live together, if you're married, you know, they'll go in the man cave and
lover,
won't come out.
Lover, not partner.
And they will not even.
You know. Mm-hmm. So are people who are just lovers, I mean, just lovers? I mean, I can't imagine that would ever work. You know, you'd have to be lovers and friends. You'd have to be lovers and partners. You'd have to be lovers and spouses. But people who are just lovers, I mean, I don't know. I just, you know.
I don't think it works
like
for women.
Word.
I think they fool themselves. Women fool themselves into thinking they're going to be happy with that. It never works out for them. But, you know, prove me wrong. The avoidant will also, and this is very painful, they will often refuse to commit. So they'll be the ones that the avoidant partner will be the one that just kind of dangles, maybe does some future talking here and there just to get the pressure off, but doesn't really make a long-term commitment. And again, let me just say, who would to the anxious? Who wants to make a long-term commitment for that kind of drama? But it goes both ways. So,
this is really interesting, because I've heard of cases of this, of women tell me, say, guys don't care. This is why I love talking to women, because I hear all this really good stuff. But there are women I know who know people, or, you know, the friend of a friend, however many down the line, they've been living with this guy for 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, 7 years, you know, whatever it is, and they're still waiting for that marriage proposal. They're still waiting for that commitment, and the guy's perfectly happy, knowing full well that she wants the marriage or the commitment, and he's perfectly happy to deny that, and that's a form of control too. In other words, he doesn't want to leave, but he doesn't want to get married either. He doesn't want an actual commitment. He wants to just kind of, you know, perpetuate this limbo state. That seems like a dark side too. I could never imagine living with someone that I wasn't intending to marry. Of course, I couldn't imagine living with someone anymore.
Exactly.
I'd write to the,
it's,
you know,
it's
just,
kind of
I,
cruel,
I
but it's a little cruel.
How's that
work
out?
I believe cruelty isn't usually intentional, and it comes from a place of wounding. So, avoidant doesn't want to actually, the avoidant might make some flowery discussions in the beginning, but when it actually gets emotional closeness and what's necessary to have a really good emotionally intimate relationship, like I said, they pull away. They tend to have a hard time even saying, I love you. Now, that's extreme. Some can. They're barely validating their partner, if at all, unable to hear their partner's feelings. So this will be somebody who if they're not walking out of the room, they're cutting you off as soon as they even imagine you might possibly be saying anything that might reflect on them in any negative way. And again, this you don't even have to be, they can't even hear sometimes what you're saying because they're so hypervigilant that you're saying something negative or rejecting, because they have their own childhood wounds and there's a reason for why they're so avoidant. But So then to talk about the feelings, they can't do it. They'll cut you off. They'll interrupt. They'll change the subject. They might gaslight or just leave somehow, either cut themselves off emotionally and be stonewalling you, just staring at you stoically and cold, or physically leaving. Yeah. Minimizing any frustrations the partner has, minimizing or just dismissing it. A lot of times there's addictive behavior here too, with both of these, with anxious and avoidant, escaping your own emotions. You're escaping your internal world because it is so painful. And if someone says or does anything that points the finger at your wounding, you're refusing to see, then that you have to escape through addiction. And that can be obviously social media, shopping, workaholism, perfectionism in cleaning the house. The house has to be clean. There's no spot of dust anywhere. Everything's perfect. Like, there's so many ways to have addictions, and but that is the coping mechanism for most.
Yeah.
Of course, but that goes unsaid.
This is fascinating. This is why I love to argue with you. Drama. And then made the comment, makeup, sex. People. Is that an addiction?
Let's get it back to sex, can we? Obviously.
Yeah,
you know, interestingly,
this is sex
though, this relationship
yeah.
can have amazing chemistry. So interesting.
Drama.
So interesting. The avoidant masculine may frequently be able to connect only during sex, and frequently can be mind-blowingly hot and passionate with the anxious.
And then won't talk to
you. I'm not saying always.
and then can't talk to you for the next, like, 8 hours.
Well, they feel they get their fix of emotional closeness, and then they're good, and your anxious is like, can we cough now?
So here's a weird thought. So if a guy is, this is how he connects emotionally. This is it, sex, right? So if you blindfolded a guy, you know, and he had sex with who he thought was his partner, and then I don't know how you do this. I'm just like spouting off the top of my head here, and then was told, no, that really wasn't his partner, it was somebody else. What, he's still, you know, I mean, in other words, if you didn't know whether it was your partner or not, you know, and it was just the sex, would that still create an emotional connection with whoever you happen to be with? And I'm looking for like a controlled experiment here. Is anything like, has there been done? It's probably not ethical, but I'm just curious, where if the only connection is sexual with someone, would it matter who the partner was?
There needs to be chemistry.
Right.
So there's a reason the anxious and avoidant got together in the first place. On some level, there's a physical attraction, and on some level that there's probably an emotional attraction. However, they just don't have the skills or tools or enough self-love
to
make it good.
This is like Ross Rosenberg's the human magnet syndrome. Narcissist and empaths, which would be the more extreme version of what you're talking about, right?
Yeah, I think so. And I do think, and again, this isn't my lane, but I like to discuss anyway. I have a feeling that a lot of people who see themselves as empaths may indeed be empaths, but it's actually a skill they've developed because they are hypervigilant, to very carefully read others, but the underlying motivation isn't necessarily to help, or it the underlying motivation is to be safe, to not be rejected, to know how to work the room, to know how to interact, to snag someone. So I feel like there might be empaths who are actually anxiously attached, and maybe it goes together, you know?
I don't think so, because I think I've always been very naturally empathic. I sense things. I feel things. Mm-hmm. I think as a talk show host, you almost have to be. But on the other hand, it's also been a survival skill. So knowing that I know how people think.
Though, like everyone wants to be. It's like a new buzzword. Everyone's calling themselves an empath, you know? And again, I'm not going to minimize that.
Yeah.
Right. It's
but
a
they're
pretty
not.
Strong meaning behind empath, right?
Yeah, look it up, folks. Well, gaslighting is another one. Mm-hmm. People are using that very casually. And I used to get after people, you know,
yeah,
I'm kind of well-versed in narcissists. Yeah, but I'm kind of well-versed in narcissism, not because I'm a psychologist, but because, you know, I've had so much experience in my life, more than anybody really should, that I know these people. I can see them coming a mile away. And I think that makes me, you know, this is why I've talked to, you know, fellow empaths, is that empaths should only date empaths. Now, granted, you're never going to make a decision, but you're really going to have a good time. You know? Because no one's going to take charge. You never decide who's going to go, you know, who's going to pick the restaurant because you're both empaths. You want the other person to decide, you know, because you're
I don't like
be fair.
That would frustrate me. Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll have like a masculine empath and a feminine empath. But anyway, it's just stuff I drove
mm-hmm.
around with. But let me go back to drama because I'm kind of curious. There are people who thrive on it, who need it, who it's almost like they're their emotional soul food. And
mm-hmm,
I avoid those
mm-hmm.
people like the plague too. Why is that? Why is creating drama necessary for some people? What do they get
mm-hmm.
out of it?
Connection. It's an unskillful
okay.
way to get connection with others, to get themselves validated.
Okay.
It's just lower on the skill level of how you interact with others. So I can create drama to get people to notice me and give me attention, to try to get connection with my partner, with my kids, mm-hmm. a desperate cry for help. I'm panicking, I'm spinning out, and I don't know how else to get support because I have abandoned myself. I don't support myself. And I'm looking externally for my environment and other people to fill up those wounds, to heal those wounds, to fill me up, to support me. Yeah, there's a lot of reasons, but it's, you know, I believe any drama and reactivity is an unskillful way to try to get needs met.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote down HOA
yeah.
presidents. You know, I was thinking about the Karens. You know, that your grass
is
a quarter of an inch too high. You know, your mailbox is not the right shade of white. You know, there's a control that goes along with this too. And so people were, you know, bosses. You know, you're five
They're
minutes
unhappy.
Late. You know, people.
Those
people
women
bring
are
drama.
Very unhappy, in my opinion.
Okay.
They're not getting their needs met in their relationships. They need to come to my class, get on the floor in their short shorts, and turn off the lights, and move their body, and sexy dance, and get cheered
mm-hmm.
by the other women. And then they're going to leave, and they're not going to care so much about that mailbox and all. They're going to be so
okay.
happy and delighted with their own body.
Yeah. If people can let go, there's so many things that we can let go of. I often wonder if you know, if you just think back to when you were 5 years old, what did you worry about when you were five? You know, dinner, you know, whether you're going to get rained on when you're playing outside. I mean, you know, things like that. But you didn't worry about climate change. He didn't worry about a lot of different things he didn't worry about. And if the more you cannot worry about things you don't have to worry about, I mean, certain things you do have to worry about as an adult. I'm not trying to diminish that. But I think people worry about things for the sake of worrying, that, like you say, they create drama as a means to an end for something. You know, they'll create drama with a partner because that's their interaction. That's their standard mode of, you know, of getting stuff going. I've seen this happen, you know, and you sort of wonder why. It's like, why are you doing this? Why are you picking a fight with me for no reason? I said, if you want to make up sex, why don't we just go right to the makeup sex, forget the argument, and we'll be a lot happier. You know, but it doesn't always work that way.
Well, because, you know, I don't know, men can do that. A lot of women really need the emotional closeness to have the sex and to get turned on.
Yeah, but you can have the emotional focus
seen and heard
a bunch of ways. You can do tantric stuff. You can do the dance of the seven veils. You can, you know, go run naked in the woods. I mean, there's probably a million things you can do. You know,
mm-hmm.
watch the sunset or sunrise, you know, at 5 a.m. and have a big brunch. And then,
I mean,
you know,
that sounds delightful for me, but there are a mm-hmm. lot of men that won't think of those things and they don't find them meaningful, you know, and there are some men that do. And I think the key is finding a partner that it thinks of things like that and wants to connect, you know, and, you know,
I
our
love
avoidant
stuff like
partners,
that.
Avoidant yeah. partners frequently don't feel that emotional connection is their responsibility in a relationship and they really are
yeah.
very comfortable with emotional neglect. They're really just very comfortable in a state of independence and emotional neglect. And so for the feminine energy in that relationship, it's very soul shattering, actually. But when you say, well, look at the stars at 5 a.m. or at midnight, that's beautiful. And a lot of women would be grateful to have a man that thought of things like that and that wanted to do that.
Oh, I'm one
mm-hmm.
of those guys, by the way, if, you know, I mean, you know where to find me, right here on Action Radio. But see, I love crazy things like that. You know, I'll go walk in the rain because it's more interesting. You know, and
yeah,
I'll go watch,
I agree,
you know, dolphins
100%.
Playing. yeah, I'll go watch playing, you know, dolphins playing in the surf, because how often do you get a chance to see that? I'll stop, you know, if you ever see my armadillo videos, I'll be on a bike ride. I'll take like 15 minutes of an armadillo video. Why? Because they're interesting. You know, and then some negative person will come along and say, well, yeah, they have leprosy. I was like, what? I said, I'm not snuggling with it. I'm just taking a picture.
Don't you hate that?
But think about it,
ruin any moment.
There's always something negative.
I mean,
yeah.
But negative Nelly. People see life that way. Yeah, and I find it fascinating. Huh. And even in the rain, my youngest child, since he was tiny, loved to dance in the rain. We didn't create that. He's the only one like that. As soon as it rained, he'd run outside as soon as he could walk and just shriek with delight. And I intentionally would make sure I never say anything like, oh, shoot, it's raining, or anything like that, because I realized that was his joy. And and if my in-laws, who are, you know, very negative, you know, and my ex-husband, you know, had a little flavor of that, and he had to really train himself also, because we never want to steal someone else's joy like that. But it's almost like a bonding. People use it to bond. They'll literally bond over negativity. Like, I tell you how awful life is and how shitty everything is, and then you agree, and then we're bonding over negativity. I am so done with it, Greg. I think it's very unhealthy. Yeah. But you know what I'm talking about.
I know exactly.
Bond over grieving everything.
There's so much. Well, I mean, negative, if you're personally negative, then your relationship's going to be negative. I mean, Marco's leaving too. So Marco, thanks very much. Marco's been with us for the whole time.
Oh, from the Netherlands?
Yep. He's with us pretty much every day now, which is great. Yeah. So we're international.
Lovely.
I was typing a quick message. But yeah, because he has to, well, we got about 3 minutes left, but you know, hey, who cares? We're having fun. But this idea of negativity, I think this is worth exploring, you know, a lot more, because if you're negative personally, how can you be in a relationship? You know, if you see everything as bad, you know, it's you know, I remember with my kid.
It's a protective mechanism. I believe it's protective mechanism.
Interesting.
Also.
But when it was raining, my daughter used to go play in the mud. You know, it was great. You know, for the boots on, she'd go jump in puddles for hours. You know, like 2 years old. So this is great. Or or like leaf piles where were meant for us to jump in. You know, and beach dunes were made to slide down. So we did everything. You know, you can go through life with joy. You can go with life where everything's negative. It's too cold. It's too hot. You know, the car doesn't work. Too far away. It's too expensive.
Einstein said that there's two types of people. Those who see everything as a miracle and those who see nothing. Or I'm probably butchering the quote, but you know this quote, there's two types of people in the world.
No, I don't. Let's look it up.
Yeah, it's Einstein. There's two types of people in the world, those that see miracles everywhere and those that never see them or something like that.
Well, you know what you and I are.
For
that's,
sure.
That's pretty, that's,
I know.
That's, yeah, so
I know what I am.
I know exactly what I am.
And it's such a lovely way to be in the world. And it's such a lovely way. And I actually do believe that everyone has that ability, and it's all about healing. It's all about healing, gratitude, turning your face towards a spiritual source of power, and just feeling grateful. Like the 10, wake up every morning and list 10 things you're grateful for, and your lens of the world begins to change. It begins to literally change your thought patterns, and before you know it, you are noticing beauty everywhere. You've become addicted to that versus the complaining and the negativity, right?
No, I agree. And, I found the quote too. It says, there are only two ways to live your life. One is as though nothing is a miracle. The other is though everything is a miracle. That's the quote.
Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah.
You know, I see everything as a miracle, you know, and it's interesting. I wonder if the people that have had challenges and, you know, drama and tragedy and humiliation and embarrassment and betrayal and all those things that I've been through. And I'm by no means the only one. I'm not claiming any special, you know, exclusion on this, but I think I see the world more as a miracle, having seen that darker side of it and having seen the psychopaths and the narcissists and the pure evil. Not that I was ever physically hurt or anything like that, but evil can be emotional, spiritual. If you can kill somebody in many ways. You don't have to physically kill them. You can destroy them in all kinds of different ways. Parents do that to kids all the time. And that's what all this healing is about. But I still see everything as a miracle, and I always have. That's the five-year-old in me that's still there. That's the part that I really like. You know, that's why I take, you know, videos of armadillos for 15 minutes, and someone else says, well, they have leprosy. you know, or you know, boats are too expensive, don't go out of them, or it's wet out there, or, you know, or all these things that people, it's like they're not living. And how do you have a relationship if you don't see, I mean, a relationship's a miracle, especially if it works, you know, but.
That's funny, especially if it works with all these traumas and woundings. And
yeah. Well, yeah, in many ways.
Well, something interesting came up, and I have to get off of it, but I just want to throw this out there. This is interesting. I'm in a female women's chat group where we talk about relationships and talk about just kind of bouncing off of each other. And it's usually very deep, you know, very deep, very, you know, psychologically based, just, you know, patterns. But this week, a woman was a little shy to say this because you and I were just talking about what a miracle it is if they work out, even if everything's in place. She had a great connection for 8 months with a guy, but the genital size was incompatible. And so she got some flack from some women. You're so, that's so shallow. Da, 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 da. You know, what if he said your boobs were too small, or what if he said your butt's too big? And her take was, I've thought about this, ladies, and I can't do anything. We're not compatible down there. And some of the wiser women were actually saying, absolutely, that's important to be compatible in that area also. And if it's important to you, then that's okay. You have to know that and move forward. Just sometimes, you know, general size and compatibility, right? Someone's maybe bigger and it's not a good feel for the other person, and someone's,
with
you
the three bears,
smaller,
too big, too small, and just right.
Deal.
You know,
yeah.
So,
right for everyone, even in that department. I really think.
Listen, this is just right with pheromones and smell. So, you know, a friend of mine said, you know, she wouldn't go out with guys that didn't smell right. You know, I mean, it's that basic, because everybody trust me, if you don't like the aroma of your partner, you're not going to be together. And
that's wise also. There's a lot to be said for that in chemistry, because chemistry and compatibility, you have to have both.
Well,
right?
It literally is chemistry. I mean, that's you know, scent and glands and the whole bit. But if we can just kind of sum up here, but I really believe, and we should talk more about this, that the belief in miracles, that the half full versus half empty, that if you're a constant pessimist, the only people who are going to be able to tolerate you are other constant pessimists, because you know, you're the misery that loves company, and you're going to be each other's company. Whereas those that believe in miracles, they're the ones that are having the fun. They're the ones that are, you know, not taking the cruise ship where everything's done for you. They're on the same ship at a 45-degree deck angle, going, you know, still feeling miserable. But it's like, we're on a sailing ship. Isn't this great? You know, that's me. I could be thrown up over the side and go, you know what? I'm really liking this boat trip. This is fun. This is different. But that's just how I see
it. I love it, too. And this is how I try to see life also. And it's, you know, it's important to me as a woman to have other people around, a supportive network, because if I'm around too many negative people, it really does, it's like a gravity yanking me down. So I've actually, you know, discovered that this past year and had a really wonderful group around me. But on that note, I have a little boy that would like some French toast. He's hungry, and that's my commitment to him at 11 o'clock.
Of course.
So,
no, let's get your contact information. And also, delightful. I just want to say that if you need a guy for your women chat groups, I'm more than happy to be the only guy and just, you know, give you a guy point of view.
So generous.
See what they say.
Yeah. These are a lot of single, successful ladies.
I'm open. I told you. You're going to find me my next girlfriend. I'm absolutely convinced of this. So, you know, wouldn't surprise me. Just don't make the commute too big, because you're in a different state. So we got to work on that.
I don't think long distance is ever a good idea in a relationship. Okay, so my contact is DorothyDiana@yoniyun.com. My website is Yoniyun. And I'm on Facebook and always happy to chat. I have a variety of topics I post, from health and detox to conspiracy theories that always end up coming true, to feminine sensuality and sexuality, which is my playground, which I love. And I lead women's groups and privates. And that's about it.
Sounds good. Oh, we don't call them conspiracy theories on Action Radio anymore. We call them ongoing investigations.
That's right. That will probably end up being true, because it seems like all of them do. But on that note, I will talk to you soon. It's been delightful. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Ellen. It's always a pleasure to have you on, and I can't wait for our next chat. So I'll talk to you next week.
Me too. All okay, right. Bye-bye.
Look for miracles. All right, see you later. And there we go. This has been Mondays are incredible around here. You know, I think I start a little disorganized. You know, it's the beginning of the week. I haven't done the show for a couple of days, you know, and it makes a difference. It really does make a difference. You take a couple of days off radio and you feel it. It's just, you know, but once we get going, once the topics get going, of course, I had Josh was immediately there, you know, when the show started this morning. That makes life easier, too. but between, you know, Pianchi and Josh and Jonathan and Dorothy, this has been pretty wild. Things going on this week. You should know that Robert Francis Kennedy is going to be before Congress on Thursday. I can't wait for that hearing. Making a little video tomorrow from the animal shelter. So you'll be able to see that Facebook Live, too, from Santa Rosa County, Florida animal shelter. You'll be able to see all the critters and see Tara D, you know, the person that I talked to on Friday mornings. That's really all I have for this week. We're pretty open this week. It's summertime. Everybody's on vacation doing stuff. But you know me, Action Radio never sleeps. There's always something to do here. And I'll be back tomorrow morning with Brianna Cannon for Government Inquiry, 7, and Jesse Cossie for the Latino Report at 8 and 9 o'clock. I always have one open hour where I can do stuff I want to talk about. And we'll see you all tomorrow, 7 a.m. Central, when we do it all again.
Action Radio. Part of the ADHD Radio Network. The ultimate free speech zone. We the people give our consent to be governed through writing the laws by which we are governed and have the power through juries to nullify the laws by which we do not consent to be governed. At Action Radio, we don't report the news. We are the news. Every other show reports what has happened. We talk about what can happen. From the questions no one has thought to ask, to the answers no one has thought to consider, to the actions no one has dared to take. That is Action Radio. This is Greg Penglis for Strikeforce, your source for pure energy. Strikeforce is a concentrated energy drink that turns a half liter of your favorite beverage into an energy drink. You make your energy drink yourself. Action Radio is an affiliate of Strikeforce, so our listeners get a 20% discount. All you do is add our code, WYL, to the discount code window at checkout. WYL comes from our website, Write Your Laws. So, you can get your energy drink, a 20% discount, and help Action Radio change the relationship of we the people to our government. Not bad. Strikeforce is at StrikeforceEnergy.com. That's StrikeforceEnergy.com. Start your engine.
Hello, this is Greg Penglis for our newest shooting range here in Milton, Florida. Stand Your Ground. My friend Jason Myers and crew are creating an incredible facility for our city. Stand Your Ground is located at 6632 Elva Street. The phone number is 850-789-1776. Their email is standyourground1776@gmail.com. Here you'll find either in process or already going an indoor shooting range, axe throwing, archery, a rage room, self-defense classes, concealed carry weapons classes, security license training, paintball, a full-service gun store, and 24/7 online ordering. So come on down or contact them by phone, email, or website and learn how you can best stand your ground. Do you know your way around healthcare, insurance, pharmacies, surgery, alternative treatments and choices? I don't. Which is why I'm so glad I met Priscilla Romans, had her on Action Radio, and learned about health patient advocacy. She is the founder of Great Care. And now as an affiliate of Great Care, we are proud to offer through our discount code, WYL, which stands for Write Your Laws, a 10% discount. Grave Care saves you both time and money. They provide medical advocacy, consultation, advice, and recommendations nationwide. Their website is gravecare.com. That's GRAITHcare.com. You can email them at gravecare.adm@gmail.com or call them at 469-864-7144.
469. That's 469-864-7149. Great care, better health through better knowledge and advocacy.
Well, that sounds good. Even better. Okay, how about your car? If you want the best service for your vehicle, please talk to James at Florida Stores Automotive. Conveniently located at 6715 Caroline Street in the historic district of Milton, Florida, right between the Milton Bakery and the Blackwater Trail. Whether you need an oil change or an entire engine replaced, this is the place. The phone number is 850-623-6651. That's 850-623-6651. Call, ask questions, and get the information you need. Florida Stores Automotive is a full-service automotive shop for both domestic and imports, modern and classic. It is a family-owned business here in our Milton community. Open weekdays from 7:30 to 5 p.m., Florida Stores Automotive is a convenient place to keep your car maintained and on the road. Ask them about Firestone tires and the rotation and maintenance plan. Florida Stores Automotive. I go there. You should too. Greg Penglis here for my book, The Complete Guide to Flight Instruction. Everyone at some point in their life wants to learn how to fly. Few try. Even fewer go on to get a license. I believe a major reason for that is how we teach people how to fly. My book is designed to help you navigate the flight training system, but it's so much more than that. It really describes an entirely new way to teach flying. So if you've never tried a lesson or got discouraged in your training and quit for any reason, this book can help you. Don't be a rote pilot who just follows procedures. Be a thinking pilot who makes great decisions, who understands all the reasons why we do what we do. You can incorporate these principles into your own flight training at any time. The Complete Guide to Flight Instruction is featured on the Action Radio with Greg Penglis Facebook page and is available from Amazon.com.